It's time for Twit. We have the best panel. Ian Thompson for the Register is here. Futurist Amy Webb is here. We're going to find out when the McRib will come back. No, she does some other stuff too. We'll also talk about the Apple and Google plan versus the one proposed by Peter Thiel's Palantir. And why are people tearing down 5G towers to fight coronavirus? It's all coming up next on a very well-dressed Twit. This Week in Tech comes to you from Twit's LastPass Studios. You're focused on security, but are your employees? LastPass can ensure they are by making access and authentication seamless, whether they're working in the office or remotely. Visit LastPass.com/Twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 768, recorded Sunday, April 26th, 2020. Steer into the skid. This episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by ExtraHop, the cybersecurity company that helps modern enterprises protect their business and keep critical systems available with cloud-native threat detection and response. Check out the full product demo and more at extrahop.com/twit. And by LastPass. LastPass manages every entry point to your business so you can mitigate risk whether you're working in the office or remote. No matter where your employees are, LastPass helps you keep peace of mind. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. And by CashFly. Give your users the seamless online experience they want. Power your site or app with CashFly's CDN and be 30% faster than the competition. Learn more at twit.cashfly.com. And by Stamps.com. Anything you can do at the post office, you can do at Stamps.com. Their on-demand postage means you can skip that trip for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a digital scale without any long-term commitment. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter the offer code TWIT. It's time for Twit, This Week in Tech, with two of my favorite well-dressed people today. Amy Webb from the Future Today Institute, amywebb.io. So lovely to see you, darling.
And lovely to see you as well. Cheers to you, Leo.
Cheers, cheers. Oh, she's drinking bubbly. I'm drinking a little Louis XIII cognac. Also, Ian Thompson joining us from theregister.co.uk. And what are you tippling today?
I'm having a Aaron's single malt, which is thankfully being so thankfully being done over here now for a change.
So this is all the reason we are so posh. It's all inspired, I think, by Ian's James Bond mustache. Sir Ian now, Fleming here.
That's exactly right. It's because of Ian's mustache that I spent 2 hours getting into a ball gown.
I spent a little bit of time without the valet here. It's kind of hard to get the cufflinks in.
Well, I've got to say, you look very glam, Amy.
I had to do it all myself.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, indeed. But, so do you.
But in fact, quick quiz, there is only one James Bond who has a mustache. Now, who is it?
It's not Sean Connery. It's not Roger Moore. It must have been.
It was the middle guy, the skiing movie one.
Not Pierce Brosnan. Did he have a mustache?
No.
It was the guy who was only in one. He was only in one.
It's the one everyone forgets. The first Bond.
Dalton, was that his name?
No.
The first Bond. There was
David
a Bond.
David Niven.
No, you're talking about Casino Royale.
Yeah.
That was not the first Bond. That was a later Bond with Woody Allen and that came after Dr. No and Goldfinger and From Russia.
There have actually been more Bonds. There was George Lazenby, right? Is that
George
what I'm thinking
Lazenby? Of the, that's it.
Yeah,
skiing.
Yeah, George Lazenby. Yeah.
Yeah, he only lasted the one series. The one film, but.
Casino Royale was a jokey Bond. That was the one with Peter Sellers.
Actually, you're right. It wasn't. It was 67.
Yeah.
So that wasn't.
Yeah, was
okay. You're right. I stand corrected.
So David Niven is definitely a tough trivia question. That is.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And he was not, the other thing I remember, he wasn't the only James Bond in that movie.
No.
There were multiple.
It was a very strange film. It couldn't decide whether it wanted to be a comedy or a drama.
But I think it wanted to be a comedy, but failed.
Yes.
So Ian was been so dapper because he's been dressing up for his daily editorial meetings on the Register and posting these crazy pictures on Facebook and Instagram. And this is the mustache, I guess, is part of that. And then you were formal and you said we should. And I think, Amy, you said we should all be formal.
Yep.
Amy's well, as long as Ian's got a mustache, I thought we should all join him.
What's nice is that so you happen to have a ball gown lying around?
I know it's shocking, right? But I have Nikes on, so I'm mostly dressed up.
Yeah, I have slippers on, but that's because
I'm wearing Crocs. I will admit.
Don't show the footwear, whatever you do. How funny!
I mean, the whole thing kicked off because after about day 4 or 5, my standards really slipped. And I started off the video news meeting in the morning and I was wearing a sweatshirt. I hadn't washed my hair at all. It wasn't even combed. And there were some justifiable comments that I was letting the side down. So then I wore this and then I started dressing up and it got slightly weird last week with the girl with the pearl earring stuff. But it was
Great. I loved the girl with the pearl earring.
I found the Photoshop slightly disturbing. But, you know.
Is that? Did you post it on Instagram too? Let me see if I can pull.
No, just on Twitter. I don't have an Instagram account, but that was a friend of mine who's just a whiz with Photoshop or GIMP or whatever it was he was using, and changed it round, and it was disturbing. Yeah. Even my mother was slightly freaked out.
Let me see if I can find it. Here it
is. You need friends who can deep fake you into that.
Yeah.
Time.
This is the Photoshopped one, not the. Although yours is pretty close.
Well, I got that. And I used to have a piercing in that ear, but I tried to get the earring through and it wasn't going
to
do it.
Oh, no. You didn't try to redo the hole, did you?
I didn't really fancy going to the ER with blood poisoning, going, okay. It's a long story, but.
Wow. Wow. It's funny what people do.
Oh, yes.
During this shelter in place.
Scaring people with a Begbie knife from train spotting was also fun, but yes.
Oh, yeah. I loved your train spotting. That was actually terrifying. Yeah. That was really scary.
And me, I'm such an even-handed chap, so, you know.
Oi!
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I got out-knifed by a member of staff who just happened to have a Japanese tree cutter by it. Just this
Lord.
Is a knife. And it was, okay, right, fine, back off. You know?
It is a great mustache. Man, if I could grow a mustache like that, I would.
This is nearly
mustache.
8 weeks' growth, though. And I think my lip's too thin. It looks like I should have a top hat on and be tying young women to railway tracks going, my pretty, I have you now.
But, it's kind of Niven-esque. I think it's good. I think it's really good.
I don't know how long.
How is your side doing, Amy, during the shelter in place? Where are you these days?
So we've got a place in New York and a place in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
New York, I did not want to ride this through there. No. So we're in Baltimore and my team is all working remote. And we've actually been, everybody wants to know the future and what to do.
Yeah. So,
it's been a very, very, very busy couple of weeks. I've been working 18-hour days.
Wow. You're kidding.
But I'm happy to do it. No,
so you're working harder because of this.
Well, yeah. I mean, contrary to what a lot of people understand about what futurists do, we don't just look out into the far future. We also look, I mean, the future is sort of always, right? So we're trying to figure out now, What do global supply chains look like in 3 months? What are the next order impacts of a federated approach to people going back to school and to work, and what liability challenges does that trigger? And like all the stuff that's happening with privacy and tech has massive, huge implications for regulation and consumer sector and all this stuff. So we're just building model after model after model. And You know,
there's only really one thing I'd like to know, and that's when will the McRib be back?
Is that an annual thing?
I don't know. It's unpredictable. Right, that's the beauty of it. You never,
I think,
never know.
The president, if anybody's going to know, or your leader would know this, right?
You're not an epidemiologist, so.
I'm not an epidemiologist, but.
How do you, well, that's the question. I mean, so the one question everybody says is, well, what's the medical prognosis? And and even the epidemiologists don't know. In fact, the WHO just put out a thing saying, you know, everybody's counting on the golden ticket, the certification that you've had it and you're immune. But you shouldn't count on that, folks, because we don't know yet if you're immune. So this whole idea of having antibodies may not even work.
Right. So something I guess I will just announce that I haven't told anybody yet. I think it's probably okay. My next book, so the book that I wrote that came out last year was on AI. The next book that I started writing before that other book came out is about the future of synthetic biology. And a lot of it has to do with viruses. Oh. Yeah. So my publisher is like, hey, could we get that manuscript now?
Let's get that out now.
So viruses are, a virus is kind of like a USB stick, you know, and like if you shove a USB stick into your computer, stuff comes out, you know, maybe good, maybe bad, maybe malware, maybe a benevolent system that can fix like broken code. It's a way of transmitting code. And really that's what a virus is. It's just code. It's a way of transmitting code. And of course the problem is we don't know, you know, like Linux is complicated. Like computer systems are like easy, but in some ways super, super complicated. And you don't always know how, if you install something new, how that might have next order impacts on all the other parts of your machine. Right. So we don't know what the bugs look like yet with this particular virus, I think is the problem. And we're not going to know this is kind of interesting. This is why supercomputers have been in the news a lot, because they're trying to crunch numbers on what are all the different ways that this virus could impact given all of these different variables. And if we introduce these types of medications, it's just like it's a compute problem at this point more than anything else. So
interesting. What an interest.
That's how I think.
That's your particular slant on it.
I mean, I don't have my background's game theory, not biology. So I don't know. And I think part of the problem is there's a lot of, the other problem that we're dealing with is this like infodemic, where there's all this information coming at us from every different direction. It's hard to tell what's believable and what's credible, and you know, it's just really challenging.
Yeah,
we've never had to have bullshit filters up quite so high. I mean, it's the amount of conflicting evidence that come with, first off, if you've got it, you're immune. Now, if you've got it, you're probably not immune. You might have 3-5% of people might have enough antibodies to give them limited resistance. They're now apparently spitting off Tom Hanks's blood for antibodies. You knew that was coming, you know?
Yeah. And everybody wants to know, will we also be better people after the injection? That would be nice.
With an interest in typewriters, but yes. I mean,
obviously, you know, I mean, I think the thing is, because this is such a new virus and we know so little about it, we can't say it behaves the same way as the flu or a cold or other coronaviruses. So, I guess people like me think, well, golly, we ought to be able to find out pretty quickly, right? And so we're all a little frustrated by the time frame of this, but it you don't know right away. So what the WHO said, and I should clarify it, is that it's certainly no evidence it confers a lifetime immunity, but there may be some limited immunity. I guess they were really concerned that some governments were poised to start offering get out of jail free cards if you had the antibodies, and they were concerned that wouldn't be a very good idea.
It also kind of blows a hole in this whole herd immunity rubbish. You know, it's just like, oh, well, if we all just get it and we'll get it out of the way and everything will be fine. That's not how it's going to work, it seems. You need to test, isolate, and kill it, just like other countries are
Amy,
doing.
Amy, do you consider what the human reaction to this will be? Because this is the thing that seems most unpredictable to me. Humans are infinitely chaotic. And so, for instance, as I'm walking around Petaluma in the last couple of days, I noticed fewer people wearing masks, more people kind of hanging out at bars. I feel like we're, and boy, you look at the beach pictures from Southern California, from Huntington Beach. I feel like we're rapidly, all of us, approaching that point where we throw up our hands and say, I can't take it. I don't care what happens. I'm going out. Can't predict that, though? We don't know, right?
No. So part of the problem is that everybody is looking for two answers. One is, what is the new normal? And two is, when is the new normal? And as a futurist, I always say, well, what would it take for X to be Y? What would it take for us to get from now to the new normal? And how long would that take? So I don't actually think people are asking about what is the new normal. I think people are really saying, when is my life going to have less change coming at it from every direction all day long?
Right.
And for that reason, we have to remember that people are capricious. So you may see people obeying rules one day and not another day. And what drives a break in that behavior? You can't, like, the behavioral predictions are really, really hard. And you can have all the social data that you want, and you can have all the behavioral biometric data that you want. Ultimately, what causes us to continue to change our minds is pretty unknown. So in a place like China, where you've got a top-down regime, very authoritarian, you know, a digital health passport works. Like, people sort of stay in the lines. They color in the lines. That is totally not going to work in most places around the world. And,
Yeah, there's a FOMO element among Westerners, anyway, where we see somebody walking around, doesn't matter if they've got a golden ticket. I want to walk around too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so, Ian.
Oh, sorry. I'm just saying, I mean, there are some, I've been doing some reading up over the last couple of weeks. There are some fascinating historical parallels with where we were with the influenza epidemic 100 years ago. In 1919 in San Francisco, there was an anti-mask league. You know, we haven't really advanced that much in the last
Isn't
century.
Isn't that funny? I read
there
that.
There were people. And in one case, a San Francisco policeman shot and killed someone who was obviously sick and not wearing a mask, wasn't prosecuted. I don't think we're going to get to that level, nor should we. But, you know, I mean, there are some fascinating parallels in that, you know, we're still quite dumb about these things. Yeah. And, you know, I don't think the lockdown's going to work in and of itself unless we sort of test and isolate, but it's certainly, we're getting there. And I agree with Amy. I mean, China's situation just isn't going to cut it in the US. I mean, we are at least lucky. You know, we are, the three of us can work from home. You know, if you work in a hospital or a grocery store, or you're an Uber driver, you are out of luck at the moment.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm trying to keep down on the, oh, it's so terrible, because at least, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Here we are sitting in evening clothes. you know, that seems unseemly, but we're just trying to cheer each other up.
That's right.
And I don't think any of us is insensate to the horrible suffering that is occurring, not just in the U.S., but all over the world because of
it. I got to tell you, however this whole thing happened over Twitter, I've really looked forward to this, mm-hmm. this whole, you know, and
me too.
I look forward to seeing you guys. I think that's, to me, that's sort of analogous to what a lot of people are going through. Life is slower and smaller than it was before. And so I think if we can keep finding moments, small moments of joy, I mean, that would be a nice after effect of this, is chasing incremental moments of joy. You know, that would probably put us all in a better place going forward.
And we've all become misinformation, fake news machines, because we all have our opinions, and we all pick and choose our stories, and we all are trying to figure out what's going on. So I'm going to leave it to the expert, Amy, and and let you do all the prognostics.
Jesus, you shouldn't do that. We're all doomed.
But it's hard because, well, Ian, you looked back to the last time this happened, and certainly there are some analogies, but also it was a very different time in 1918. I mean, the world was a very different place,
And well, I mean, can you imagine if this had hit 25 years ago before we had the internet?
Right.
You know, I mean, it would have been catastrophically worse.
Yeah.
Because at least there are some people that can work from home. We've got decent communications with our friends and family through, you know, Skype and online and social media and the rest of it. I don't know about you two, but I found myself spending way more time on social media than I would normally, just to keep up in contact with people. You
know, that's you're why I kind of swallowed my pride and rejoined Instagram and Facebook.
That was you. I wasn't sure whether to click on yes or not because it was just
I
like,
should have worn my tuxedo.
Is this a spammer or what?
No, it is me because and I thought for a couple of reasons. One, journalistically, I kind of am curious what's going on there during this, but also it's one way that I could stay in touch with people like you and Amy. Because, well, not Amy, you're not on Facebook, but with Ian anyway. No, you're not on Facebook. So I don't stay in touch.
I mean, I have a public profile, but I don't actually use Facebook.
Some of my family and friends and even colleagues are posting on Facebook. One of the things that was interesting, Larry Magid posted, he was at CES, came back, CES, this is January, came back deathly ill. And now we're learning that antibody tests have shown that there were people at CES who had COVID-19. Everybody, it's very common to come back from the Consumer Electronics Show ill with the flu or with a cold. I did not, but Larry tagged me because we had met up. He tagged all the people he met that he could remember that he met at CES and asked them. And a great many of them suffered very similar symptoms to COVID-19, the worst flu I've ever had. I could barely move, that kind of thing. And so there's some question now. I thought we dodged a bullet. I thought, boy, if this had emerged a couple of months earlier out of China, CES would have been a disaster movie. But maybe it was just a slow-moving disaster movie.
I got the sickest I've ever gotten at CES a couple years ago.
Yeah. That's why I didn't take it so seriously, because everybody always did, even in the old days.
Yeah. No, I mean, conference cough is a way of life at CES, but they had RSA in February in San Francisco, and I went along to some of the sessions on that. And again, I had... The week after, I had the worst flu of my life. I had to turn down a Twit because I'd coughed myself so hoarse I could barely speak.
Yeah,
I haven't been that sick in a decade.
Two people tested positive at RSA, so you may well have gotten it.
And
I think everybody's very interested in this antibody story because, A, antibody tests seem to be coming along a little faster than tests for COVID-19 seem to be.
But like, what does that...
But what does it mean?
What are people... Right. So I think the challenge is... So I'm actually going for a test tomorrow for an antibody test.
Oh, wow.
I think I was probably an early community spread case in New York. The problem is nobody would give me a test.
Right.
I was... I was sick at CES years and years ago. And then I got horribly ill at the end of February, and I had asthma as a kid, and I still have it, got exercise induced asthma now. I couldn't breathe. Anyhow, so I'm going in to get a test tomorrow, and it's a little like I'm kind of in a Schrodinger situation because I'm working with the assumption now that I've had it and I'm feeling great. You know, like
have the golden ticket.
Somebody that I know did test positive and we were in close contact. And since I haven't been sick since, I just did the math. And in a way, knowing that he tested positive and then me doing the math, I felt this sense of relief that I cannot describe. I've been living with that relief. I've still been taking all the precautions, but just, you know, a sense of calm. I'm going to go in for this test tomorrow. And then what's on the other side of it?
Will you be horrifically disappointed if you
the false negative rate, the false positive rate on the COVID test is low. The false positive rate on the antibody test is high. So I don't know what
I've read that there are some number of COVID tests that received that emergency dispensation the FDA has been offering, which means I gather that they're not as thoroughly tested as one would hope. And there have been in all of the tests some number of false positives and false negatives. So how reliable is the test is one question. What does it even mean if you have the antibodies is another question. And and what does it mean regarding, you know, I told my son who came back from Bali and 7 days later got pretty sick. Well, you probably had it. And if you test positive for the antibodies, you can get a job. Congratulations. You can work anywhere in the world because you'll be magic. Worry. Right. Or well, will he?
That's a concern. I worry a lot that we are entering this strange new stratification between those who have tested and can prove that they've got antibodies and those that don't. And if this winds up protracted over the next, you know, 12 to 24 months, which it very likely could, I'm going to have privileges. I already have privileges, but I'm going to have, you know, the people who have the antibodies are going to be a privileged class in whatever country, wherever they happen to be living. And I think that that's going to cause a lot of psychological problems. I think that's going to cause, it's going to help potentially restart our economy, but it's also going to cause a lot of social unrest. I mean, I don't know. I'm concerned about I think on the one hand, like getting the antibody test good and giving it to everybody and focusing a lot on that or as much on that as we are a vaccine is important, but I don't know what to do about this, like, two classes of society, those who have been infected and those who haven't.
Well, that's one thing this is definitely brought to light is the vast inequalities in American society, at least. And that's just going to be one more. And I think that's one of the reasons the WHO, when I say the WHO, I think of Roger Daltrey, the World Health Organization put out that letter on because they want on Friday or Saturday, because they really didn't want countries to go around giving people these, you know, gold stars that wear on their forehead. It's a really interesting time. And one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, Amy, is besides I missed you, but is because this is kind of the meat that you deal with all the time. But you're in a unique position now during a massive crisis where everybody's trying to predict the future. But how accurate can your crystal ball be? I mean, what kind
of...
What's the level of information you give people? What do you say to them? Yeah. Ford, for instance, is trying to figure out, are we going to have cars to sell in the fall? Will there be customers at all? Should we make them? What should we do?
Yes, I'm familiar with those questions at Ford.
I bet you are.
So here's what you do. We have this, like, little diagram. I'll post later somewhere, but... it's a cone, a futurist. So my job is not about predictions. It's about preparation. And that's not a hedge. That's just acknowledging the complications of multivariate equations, right? We're dealing with too many variables.
Right.
So instead of using a timeline to mark between now and the future, we use a cone. And the further out in time you go, the more uncertainty there is. Therefore, we have a wider spectrum of possibilities. But whatever we do in the near term, we have to do thinking about downstream implications. And we also have to imagine a plausible future state and reverse engineer that back today. And the analogy that I've been using a lot is one that maybe the two of you don't have to deal with where you live, but I do. And that's driving on a slippery, ice-covered road. So anybody who's been behind the wheel, and I grew up in the Midwest, so like part of learning how to drive is you have to prove you can drive on ice. You know, if you're driving along... and you hit a patch of ice, the instinct that we have is to slam on the brakes. And of course, that's the wrong thing to do. And I think everybody sort of understands that, but it's good to ask why. And the reason is because if we slam on the brakes, you could theoretically steer the car to safety if you were in charge of every single variable. If you knew exactly what the PSI of all four of those tires were, you knew exactly how tight the transmission, you know, and the gear shift and everything else was, you knew exactly what the incline was. Basically, you had to be like omniscient, but we're not. So instead, when you hit an icy patch, you're supposed to steer into the slide, which feels wrong. But you do that while looking at the road ahead. And that sort of slows down what's happening. To me, that situation is analogous to the one that we're in right now. So there's all this, like, all these data coming in from everywhere, right? Which is kind of like being on this road where you're sliding out of control. And the issue is everybody wants to slam on the brakes and go back to normal, right? Which is where we get all of these, how soon does the economy reopen? How soon do we go back to school? And instead, what we have to do is to kind of like lean into uncertainty. We have to be totally open to everything being different at all times right now, because we're in the middle of it, while keeping an eye on the road ahead and steering into that direction.
Wow.
What I'm noticing is we're very consumed with what's happening right now because it's a crisis, which I totally understand, but I don't see enough people with one eye on the road ahead steering us into a direction. And I think that's the biggest problem that we're facing right now, even though I know the immediate problems feel much more acute. And that's when you look at what Google and Apple are doing with, they're not calling it contact tracing, they're now calling it something else with Bluetooth. And the fact that all of that came out of the private sector, and we don't know what the road ahead looks like, or even if having all of those data, I mean, what does that really do, you know?
But it's sensible to do it just in case we can use it, right?
Well,
I don't know. I mean, that's... Yeah,
all right, let's take a break, because this is, of course, one of the big topics we've been discussing all week, which is the Google-Apple API. That's going to be pushed out, and eventually an app, perhaps. And in fact, in Europe, there's been some pushback. France said, we want more data. Apple said, you can't use Bluetooth if you exfiltrate the data. You can't keep the data. France is upset about that. Germany at first said, we're not going to do it either for the same reason. Now they've come along and said, okay, as of today, Germany said, yeah, we'll use this API. A lot of privacy advocates are very concerned that this could be used against us down the road. Google and Apple have released a number of follow-up white papers. In fact, they've even changed the algorithms a little bit to say it's, you know, the data will be destroyed at the end of this. So this is a big battle going on. And honestly, I think that the Google-Apple solution is better than the one proposed by the Pan-European Commission, which is much more data intrusive. Ironically, given that the GDPR came out of the EU. So there's a lot to talk about here, and I think we have two very good people to do it. Ian Thompson from theregister.co.uk. Thank you for being here today. We really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
Mr. Bond. There's actually no Bond woman's name that I could give you without insulting you, so I'm just going to stop with the Bond analogy. The wonderful Amy Webb, looking fantastic in black velvet.
I would take Q. You could call me Q.
Q's a woman in the later movies. Yeah.
Yeah,
I like Q.
Q over M.
Lisa last week said, let's watch a Sean Connery movie, any Sean Connery movie. And I popped up Never Say Never Again, which was the kind of the weird...
Oh, no. It's the worst.
Well, in a way, it's the worst. In a way, it's the best, because he's an older gentleman. I liked it. I mean, they're all terrible.
Come on. Goldfinger is a classic.
Goldfinger might be the best. I was a Dr. No fan. But anyway, well, that's for, we could talk about that too. But let's take a little break. Our show today brought to you by ExtraHop. They originally started out as a way to monitor your network for performance. It turns out when monitoring for performance, and this is not just your local network, but the cloud, everywhere, all the way to your end user, you also can learn a lot about threats. With more and more companies going fully remote, the bad guys are out there ready to take advantage of this. So it's more important than ever for organizations to really see everything active in their enterprise, from the cloud all the way down to the IoT devices employees are using to do their jobs from home. Remember the NASA employee that brought a Raspberry Pi into the NASA network and caused a data breach because he said, well, I just want to bring my Raspberry Pi in. These are the kinds of things you need to know. And since many of your employees are working at home, you need to know about everything in their environment too. In order to protect and scale your business, you need more than just visibility. You need fast, reliable, actionable information about threats and remote access problems. You need it in context so that you can do something about it. And that's what Extra Hop does. It helps you detect threats and performance issues 95% faster and respond 60% more efficiently. You'll get complete visibility on every asset in real time and at scale. In fact, I want to invite you to go to extrahop.com/twit. They've got a demo dashboard so you can see what that data in real time looks like and how you're going to be able to see it and act on it. You can secure your enterprise. Everybody's enterprise is now hybrid. Wherever it is today, wherever it goes tomorrow, automatically detect new rogue and unmanaged IoT devices. See everything in your environment from the cloud to the data center all the way to the customer. And there are a lot of people using ExtraHop now. In fact, they're getting some real love. I'll give you an example. Wizards of the Coast, their chief architect, Dan McDaniel, they're using it for their AWS cloud. McDaniel said, there is no other company, this is a direct quote, that aligns to supporting the DevOps model, the speed and the lack of friction than ExtraHop. He loves it. The Home Depot is using ExtraHop to manage and secure 2,300 remote sites because they say there is no data set more complete and accurate than the data set we get from ExtraHop. That these are real users getting real benefit in a very challenging environment. Now is the time to take control of your cloud security. ExtraHop, ExtraHop. They've got a lot of resources at the website. You can get tips on securing and supporting remote access. And as I said, that incredible full product demo, which is just fun to watch. It's really cool. ExtraHop.com/twit. Take a look. I think you'll find this is exactly what you've been looking for. ExtraHop.com/twit. We thank them for their support in this difficult time. All of our sponsors are extra special to us right now. And we thank you for supporting us by going there. ExtraHop.com/twit. So the Google-Apple proposal is, I think, in many ways superior to and more trustworthy than something a government would propose. And this is everything's flipped on its head these days. But it's pretty clear governments, or at least it's certainly a reasonable fear that governments might use this kind of data gathering, just as they used the Patriot Act long after 9/11, to invade our personal privacy and security. You know, it's a great opportunity. And I think with companies like Google and Apple, whom I think you can reasonably say not only have great technical expertise, but also have a great interest in security and privacy. Certainly Apple does. You might debate about Google's interest in privacy, but I think they do, and it's tip-top security experts. I think I trust something from Google and Apple more than I would trust anything offered by France or Germany or the U.S. government. Ian, you disagree?
Actually, kind of agree and disagree. Apple and Google, I actually trust to be reasonably safe with their data, because that is, with Apple's case, that's their selling point. With Google's place, that's kind of a commitment they've made. The one company name that we're missing out of this is Palantir. Palantir has been given contracts by the US government and by EU states as well to do roughly the same sort of thing.
My point exactly. Now, I would rather have Apple and Google do it than Palantir do it.
Well, exactly. I mean, Palantir have got all the, you know, morality and self-restraint of a Labrador left with an unguarded roast chicken. I mean, they will take all that stuff and pile it into whatever they can, keep it, copy it. I don't trust them further than I could throw them. Incidentally, where is Peter Thiel, by the way? He's been very quiet this last month.
I'm sure he's
down
in
New Zealand.
Missile silo or somewhere. Yeah, a lot of, you know, it's funny. New Zealand has done a very good job thanks to their stellar PM. Even before this, last year, we were talking about the fact, I think I was told by one of our wealthy community members that his peers had already all purchased places in New Zealand for hidey holes. I think they were more worried about world unrest and nuclear demolition and climate change. But now maybe it turns out not a bad place to be if you have a virus going after you, too.
Well, did you hear the story about the VC who actually purchased one of these places in New Zealand?
No.
Flew down there just before the ban, got to the bunker and couldn't remember what the entry code was and couldn't get tech support to let him in. He was hanging around outside. I mean, it's the I've got a New Zealand tech journo friend who's just saying awful lot of private flights came into New Zealand just before the ban came in.
Yeah.
And you know, there's the little island down on the South Island where all the millionaires hang out. And all of a sudden, there's a lot of American accents being heard. So,
Man.
But I mean, but coming back to
your millionaires are on boats.
Say again?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Millionaires are in New Zealand. The billionaires are on their boats.
They're on their yachts. Yeah,
their
apparently, if you don't have a yacht, you can rent one and just ride around in style because nobody can get to you.
Did you see David Geffen's enormously tone-deaf post? I mean, it was just butter-clenchingly bad. It was just like, yeah, I'm riding out isolation in my yacht. And it's like a 70, 80-foot yacht. And you're like, really? You're looking for sympathy? It's like Ellen saying, oh, I'm in jail in my mansion. Life is so tough. You know,
it's a nice yacht, I admit. But
oh, my God.
It's a little tone-deaf to complain about that.
There's a lot of that. And there's been some backlash against celebrities, too, who are, you know, whining. Sam, what's his name, sitting in his mansion pretending to be sad. In his, you know, 20,000 square foot mansion.
But coming back to what you were saying about sort of the data handling, on one level, having a COVID tracking app like that could be incredibly useful. But in and of itself, it's not going to do that much. You've got to, if you tie it down with isolation and with dealing with infection in isolated units, then it could be useful. But just having a tracking app on your phone the whole time that tells you you may or may not. It comes back to the false positive thing that you were talking about, Amy. I mean, the amount of potential false positives and panic this could cause, I'm not sure if it's worth, you know, because we can't enforce it, I'm not sure if it's actually worth going ahead.
I agree. And so this is what I'm seeing happening. And I think Leo made an excellent point, which is, I mean, really, we're faced with a fundamental question of our time, which is, who do we trust? Do we trust our government structures, which have given us a lot of reason to mistrust them? Or do we trust our technology companies, which don't always offer the level of transparency and traceability and explainability that we may ask of them? Now, there's no question that Apple's differential privacy work is above and beyond everybody else's. They made some, I think, there was a little bit of an early mistake, at least on the Apple-Google partnership, with how they were doing encryption, which I think has kind of been shored up. But the real question here is, what is the point? So in China, you can move about, but you are scanned. There is a code, and you have to show that code, which theoretically could be spoofed, maybe, to move around. This is an opt-in system in the United States. We don't know exactly what happens with the metadata from Bluetooth transmissions. We don't exactly know where the oversight is going to lie. I mean, if it's something that's being built by Palantir for government, there's a government structure in the GAO to do accountability and auditing after the fact. But in the private sector, we don't have that. We just have the market. And so in a free market economy, the market's going to tell us whether or not this was a success or a failure. But in the middle of all this, who owns the database of people who have tested positive? And that really begs the question, who owns our genetic data? Is it us?
Yes.
I mean, we don't really have legal answers to those questions in the US or the EU at the moment. And so to Ian's excellent point, what does all of it matter? So like, fine, you get a beep. Somebody tells you that you've maybe come into contact. Now what? There's no vaccine. You may or may not be able to get an antibody test. You know, you may have found out that information because it's opt-in at any point. So you don't know if the person that you've come into contact with tested positive 2 months ago and you maybe just saw them yesterday. Like, there's a temporal element here that's like super, super important. Otherwise, the data are just like, sometimes more data is not good. It's just more. And it could seed misunderstanding and confusion and fear. And at the moment, I think what we could use is a shot of confidence. And, you know, maybe not the bleach, but definitely a shot of confidence.
Isn't it? One thing that we've got to keep in mind is that, and again, I'm not an epidemiologist. I don't even have to say that out loud, but I'll say it anyway, that we don't have to be perfect. We just have to reduce the infection rate, the R naught of the virus. If we can get it below one, then it will slow down and die out. And so any solution doesn't have to be universally adopted. It doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be effective enough that you reduce the communicability.
Yeah.
So I'm not an epidemiologist, but I am married to a doctor. And what I believe is happening is we just have to wait for the virus to... In the virus running its course, everybody is going to get infected. So we just have to sort of slow this all down so that everybody can get infected who's going to get infected.
And I don't want to get infected because the more... Now, maybe this is propaganda, but there's been a lot of stories lately about how devastating this is, getting young people having strokes, damage to organs like the liver and the heart, besides the lungs, long-term consequences, even if you survive. It doesn't sound like a good illness to get.
No, it does. I mean, again, I would agree.
So I don't want to get it.
Mm. Right. So well, I think,
does that mean that I have to stay inside? I mean, I don't mind. I don't care what government says. I don't care what skip tracing, contact tracing we've got. I'm staying indoors and wearing a mask for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. I'm not suggesting that we go the route of the anti-vaxxers and have everybody get together and give each other measles or smallpox or whatever. That is not what I'm saying. I think the issue is, we can't effectively stop it. And so in the interim, they're just trying to slow it as it spreads.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, the analogy I heard of
the old flatten the curve thing. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the problem is unless you're willing to take the kind of steps that China has, which I don't think America is, then you're going to have to accept there is going to be a pool of people out there who are constantly spreading it on and spreading it on. It's kind of like a swimming pool. You can't have a no peeing section of the swimming pool and expect that to stay pure. If the water is going backwards and forwards and we're all going to get it. So, I mean, unless you're actually willing to take a medical approach, lock down, isolate, backtrace the people, which would at this point would just be a colossal task, which I don't think Americans are going to stand for, then honestly, yeah, I don't see an awful lot of, until we get a vaccine then that works, then we're all going to be at risk for the next year or so, as far as I can see.
And so I don't think we have to think about this in fatalistic terms. I mean, there are, and this is the part that really irritates me. Can't we muster the full might of human ingenuity to think our way through this problem in terms that aren't binary? Isn't there a future that involves vaccines and antibody tests and a bunch of other things, right? Couldn't somebody design a better mask? Couldn't we figure out some other way to do meaningful information spread and data collection in a way that's not... half-assed.
Well, it feels like that is happening, though. Isn't that what Google and Apple are trying to do? I mean, maybe it's not perfect, but that's the goal.
Yeah. So it's interesting. But again, I haven't seen them answer. I guess I've heard now that there's the data are just being transmitted and are de-identified. But doesn't there have to be a database somewhere? I mean,
no.
Are they using distributed ledger? Is this a blockchain project? Like where...
It is distributed. So you keep track of the contacts you've made on your phone. Mm-hmm. And if you test positive, that data is sufficient to reverse, to tell those people without telling them about you. But you're maintaining it. There's no, as far as I could tell, there's no central database of who met who when. And Apple, by the way, and Google have in an addendum said, we will destroy this data as soon as it's over. This data is not going to be preserved. Because it could be reverse engineered at some point if you get the whole database. But I think this is quite clever. In other words, I think they've very cleverly thought of a way to do this, minimizing the privacy. I worry, though, a little bit. It sounds like people are saying, look, we're all going to get it. We're just trying to slow it down. We're all going to get it. And what they're leaving out is because at some point it's got to be back to business as usual.
Mm. I don't know. I think that one of the things that this virus has illustrated is that at least in the United States, we are all living very different types of lives. And the virus has disrupted everybody in fundamentally different ways. I mean, and it's a shared experience, but it's also not a shared experience.
It very much depends on, you know, income inequality, you know, where you stand, what your job is. If you're a waiter, it's a lot harder. If I mean, and I know so I'm dressed as a waiter, but fortunately, I don't have to make a living as one.
No, so I think the challenge here is I think that it's too reductive to say like we're just trying to get the economy moving again. I don't think it's just that. But we don't have any. Listen, I'm politically independent, staunchly so. However, I am always in favor of smart people in charge of things. And we have a situation where we just don't have the right people. We don't have decisive leadership. I think it's super interesting that in the United States, we're reverting back to a 300-year-old model where we've got regional authorities versus a strong national authority. And it's really, you know, this is kind of a similar model to what's happening in Europe, which sort of neuters the promise and position of the executive branch in the United States. I don't know.
I have to say, Amy, I'm shocked and horrified that you don't feel that a labradoodle breeder is the kind of person that we need in charge of this operation. I mean, he's clearly reliable.
We're talking about.
So the first time I heard that, I was like, okay, so he's like retired. Capable person. He must be retired. No. He's super into dogs. No. He's coming out of retirement. Like the person who invented the N95 is coming out of retirement.
Right.
That must be what's happening. Right? Somebody?
Yeah.
No.
No, I mean, unfortunately, we're back to Katrina and heck of a job brownie territory. I mean, it seems at this point. It just seems, and you've seen it
Brian Harrison, who Alex Azar picked as the guy to lead the Health and Human Services coronavirus response.
Is The Onion writing on news right now? Because this is just bizarro world.
You saw The Onion a month ago wrote a story saying, predicting, I guess I should just retire, right? Yeah. The Onion is now doing my job.
We give up. Yeah.
I know. It's a bizarre, I mean, and you just look at the faces of the doctors in these press briefings and they're just dying inside. I mean, for goodness, I mean, I get what you're saying, Amy. There is this breakdown now, and particularly in the last couple of weeks between state and federal governments. I mean, where you've had positions where states have ordered medical supplies, PPE, masks, the rest of it, and when they've ordered them, paid for them, they've turned up, the federal government has seized them and rooted them Lord knows where. There is some really, really weird stuff going on in American politics at the moment. And as a foreigner, I have to say I'm finding it slightly trying to keep up with where this is going. You've always had this, it seems, this contrast between the state, the friction between the states and the federal government, but it's really coming to the fore right now.
I haven't seen it in my lifetime. I haven't seen anything like this. And there's always politicking happening. So you've got a Republican governor in Maryland, Larry Hogan, who I actually think is doing a pretty good job. You've got Cuomo in New York, who I did not like before this, but now think he's doing a pretty good job.
Suddenly everybody likes Andrew.
Right. But this, again, this is kind of analogous to sort of other themes that we all deal with in our work, in our life. And that is, when we are all sharing a common problem that's acute and needs attention, you either need a very strong logistics network running the show, or you need a strong leader running the show. And the problem in the United States is that we neither have decisive top-down leadership nor a central authority that's running like point on all of this. There was a sort of awful story that I read, I think in the New Yorker, or it might've been the Times. No, it wasn't. It was an opinion piece that Vint Cerf shared with me on Medium that I will try to find because it was great. That explained the problem that we're in is not because we weren't prepared. It was because there were too many preparation plans and nobody knew which one to use. Let me see if I can find it.
That's an interesting. Interesting point of view.
I mean, my understanding is that we actually had preparation plans in place 5 years ago. We had CDC teams in China. We had a pandemic plan, and that appears to have been abandoned for some reason. I don't know enough about sort of the ins and outs of it, but certainly the reports were. I mean, it seems
honestly,
like
though, how this is an interesting conversation, and everybody's having it, but I don't know how useful it is to say what might have been or what we could have done better or
totally. No. We're debriefing at the beginning of a project.
Debriefing. Yeah.
You debrief at the end, right? Now is not the time for debriefing. Now we've got to go. We're on a project sprint. We've got to get to the next part.
It seems to me, but I may be wrong, that the basic instinct of the average American is to do the right thing. I think that it was everybody understood the idea, the notion of flattening the curve. Not everybody, but enough people did. People are trying to self-isolate. In fact, by the way, not just America, all over the world. It's kind of inspiring in some ways to see the entire world say, oh, I get it. We got to stay home. I can do that and do it, even though for many it's a huge economic nightmare. I think that's kind of inspiring. Honestly, you can have leadership at the top, but it takes good followship to do it.
Yeah.
Right.
It takes trust.
Yeah.
But we're not. But you know what? We're trusting. So what are we trusting in? We're not trusting in our leaders. We're trusting in medical authorities. And we're listening and we're acting. And I think most people are doing the right thing.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I was never so proud of my countrymen. There was some lovely video last week of, you know, there's all this footage of the Italians singing to each other in their apartments. And there was something else in Germany and something else in Spain. And somebody posted this thing online, and it was someone started to sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow in the middle of a crowded apartment block in London. And about five people just shouted, shut up, we're trying to sleep. And it was just like, that's my country.
I kind of think it's interesting to watch what's happening. I don't care what Governor Newsom says in our state or President Trump says, or even what the WHO says. I'm going to wear my mask, and I'm going to stay home as long as I can. I'm fortunate because I can work that way, but I see no problem, and we're not going to reconvene TWIT. We found a way for everybody to work at home. And I think, there are a lot of people who are not working. And I think I also see a lot of people helping out, trying to raise money and buy food and help people who aren't making a living during this time.
Yeah, and I hate to give anybody any ideas. Nobody, all awesome people listen to the show. I'm sort of heartened by the fact that we haven't seen significant upticks in ransomware attacks on critical infrastructure and our healthcare. And,
it was nip and tuck for a while. Remember, the HSS was attacked initially. But I think, maybe even the hackers thought better of it. I hope so.
Well, I think they knew that if they did it, then the authorities were going to come down on them like a ton of bricks because it's the perfect opportunity. It's just like, fine, let's identify these people. Let's hang them up in the public square as they deserve to be done. And there does seem to be a drop off in ransomware attacks against hospitals and healthcare facilities. Yeah. Unfortunately, that has also led to a stepping up of attacks against financial institutions and some other types of business. But honestly, this could be the chance to get a really good community spirit going. And it's been amazing. In our neighborhood, people are actually talking to each other on a regular basis. Okay, shouting at each other from 6 feet away. But, we got together on everyone's lawns and we all sat at the glass door and we talked things through. What could we do if somebody was having problems getting groceries? Someone else agreed to go and pick it up for them. I think this could be the beginning of something really quite good in terms of rebuilding actual social networks within those that we live with and care about.
I just was saying this to my husband today. America in some ways feels more like Southern Europe, which is my way of saying slower. Like I'm very, very, very busy at work, but I feel less stressed out for some reason. I'm stressed in other ways now, but I feel like I'm having smarter, better conversations with people, more thoughtful conversations. I'm certainly asking if I can help people out more. I don't know. I generally feel better toward the people around me than either indifferent or like, I got to be somewhere, get out of my way, sort of, you know,
yeah,
feeling that you get in New York. Yeah.
In France, the courts have ruled that Amazon may not sell non-essential items. They would be fined 100,000 euros for any delivery that violates those conditions. Amazon had appealed this French court ruling, but lost in the Versailles Court of Appeals.
See, we've had this
here in the United States. They're still delivering. I know because I'm getting things like pretzels. They're still delivering non-essential items.
We see we've had this problem in the United Kingdom where a British policeman went on air and said, look, we will be checking supermarket trolleys to make sure that you're getting essential items only, which led to a massive thing. So, well, hang on, we're British. Is gin an essential item? And, you know, wars are...
I'm willing to stipulate anything you could buy in a grocery store is essential.
Yeah, and the police did back down on that one. I mean, it all comes down to what you think is essential. Now, you know, are hair clippers essential? Well, technically not. You can live without them, but a lot of people are trying to buy them at the moment because, you know, we don't all want to go... Well, actually, I'm quite looking forward to going shaggy, but still.
Do you think we should have restrictions in the U.S. on what Amazon can sell? Remember that Amazon is putting workers at risk by selling anything, essential or non-essential. The more stuff they sell, inessential stuff, the more warehouse workers are put at risk, the more delivery people are put at risk. Is that too heavy a price to pay? Should Amazon not be making money or trying to make more money at this time, but instead limit it to just stuff that people absolutely need? Admittedly, Amazon provides a great service because it is one of the few ways people can get essentials.
So here's what I've been wondering. Amazon has something called AWS RoboMaker, which was built, and I don't know if it's launched at scale yet, but the whole point of it was to help companies test and deploy intelligent robotics applications at scale in the cloud, which means you have a physical group of robots that can work collaboratively, share the data, improve, and if you push a change to one, it sort of pushes to all. You know, and those are not intended as toys. I believe those are intended in places where you would have a lot of repetitive tasks and motions, like a warehouse.
Right.
And Amazon's also got Scout, which it had been testing in outside of Seattle, which looks like it's a land-based drone, similar to Neuro, but smaller. And, you know, all I can wonder is at what point has Amazon had the capability to push some of these services out at scale and chosen not to reduce the spotlight, the federal oversight spotlight from different countries, right?
But boy, it feels like if Amazon wanted to automate its workforce, now would be the time to do it.
And I've been sort of wondering if we're going to start seeing that at some point, especially because there's so much, there's suddenly over the past like month, there's been an increase in investment, increase in workflow around collaborative robotics and drones, land-based drones, air-based drones. And there's never been a better time to do geospatial mapping because you got nobody outside you got nobody overhead, right?
But no, I think this is exactly the point. Amazon is, as you say, they've been putting money into automating the warehouse jobs and getting rid of the fleshy component on that for quite some time. Perfect time to introduce it. But I do feel that it's slightly disingenuous amongst a lot of tech companies because one of the first things Amazon did, I think it was a week or 10 days ago, was cut commissions to third-party suppliers. This is a great time to lock down your supply chain, get rid of all these tiny third-party people who don't really make you that much money. It's much easier to deal with just 10,000 big suppliers than a million small ones. Good time to get the workforce replaced by machines because you can say it's being done by the public health thing. Google and Facebook are dropping advertising rates left, right, and center to try and squeeze out third-party platforms as well. There's a lot of quite nasty stuff going on in all this, but, you know, it's the way the technology progresses.
Yeah, that's why we're dropping our ad rates. We want to squeeze out all those other podcast networks. Dominate. Google may be reducing its ad rates because that's they're just desperate to get ads.
Well, they're not exactly short of cash, though, either, are they?
No.
I mean, you could ride this one out.
Yeah.
But, you know, it does seem like there's a little bit of vulture capitalism going on here.
I like vulture capitalism. I haven't heard that before.
Oh, you obviously don't read the Register.
I do, but I don't remember seeing that.
I think that's all they call it.
This just seems like an accelerating factor.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And if there was ever a time, to push forward something that's going to result in technological unemployment and do it in a way that would escape the immediate response by regulators, now would be the time to do it.
On the other hand, I think every brand has to be extra cautious because you don't want to be perceived as taking advantage of this situation. That would, I think, give you an everlasting black mark.
Right. And again, I think given where we are and the high degree of plausibility that we are going nowhere over the summer and that a lot of schools could be delayed this fall and for all good reasons. Again, at what point do they start slowly rolling out some of these systems and programs in a way that help us? You know, the first rollouts will be for medicine, I'm sure. Medicine and certain types of groceries to people who are older and can't get out. And that will help, you know, make it easier to start delivering all kinds of other things without people.
Yeah. I mean, I'm torn because both my parents are in their 80s. My dad's got a lung condition, so I don't want him going out to the shops.
No.
I'm really quite happy that Amazon can actually deliver this stuff.
Yes.
But I don't know how you guys are dealing with it, but when we get an Amazon package, it goes onto a sideboard area, which is sort of taped, and it's left there for 2 days just to sort of
I can't do that. I try to do it, but it's like Christmas Day. I can't.
Give me the package now.
Well, so that's one of the issues with information, right? We don't know if setting it aside, there haven't been consistent studies on how long virus stays on cardboard. So at any rate,
just wash your hands after you open it, right?
We have to get stuff.
Yeah.
My dad's on a slew of medications. He's afraid to go out. I'm afraid to go out. You know, I think that even with all of the precautions, and again, it's like this is what a futurist does, right? We're not trying to predict what happens. We're trying to sort of figure out what signals are there, where do we have data, and what are the plausible implications if we start connecting some of these things?
So we can steer into the skid.
And listen, if we are all much more flexible and okay with ambiguity, which is hard, and if we're willing to lean into uncertainty, all of this becomes a lot easier. The challenge is that everybody wants certainty and they don't want any answer to change once it's been given to them. But the math doesn't work out on this one. There's no real way to game out every possible future state and then calculate which one we're headed to all the time.
No, you can't. I'm just as in my own head, and I don't have any training, I could think of 100 scenarios. It's just unknown. I feel a little bit like the captain of the Titanic. Let's pour out the last vestiges of this. We don't know, and we'll see another vintage like it and take a break. Cheers, all.
Cheers.
This is the formal version of TWiT. We're just trying to cheer ourselves up because Ian does it on all of his Zoom calls. What software does the Register use for their conference calls?
Actually, we use Google Hangouts.
Hangouts is good, yeah.
Because we're a G Suite company, but I've got to say Hangouts has held up pretty well. It's only had 2 days where it's really dropped the ball big time, and I'm not that keen on Zoom because it's a great platform, but it's been forced to go to scale really, really quickly, and has such a huge amount of intense hacking has been going on to try and find out where the vulnerabilities are. And it's no worse than any other video conferencing platform. It's just been under scrutiny much more.
Yeah.
So I figure Google Hangouts, but there was a lovely story that I saw at the weekend. Google's head of business development was apparently having one of the Google video meetings and was asked by one of his staff.
Oh, that's so funny.
You saw this one?
Yes.
Oh, it's just genius.
Go ahead.
I didn't
tell us.
See it.
Tell us.
Tell me.
Oh, okay. He was just like, he was asked by a Google staffer, why is it that Zoom is eating our lunch? You know, it's like, we've been doing this for years. Why are they such? And then this guy's child walks in. He goes, oh, Dad, are you on Zoom? All my friends really like Zoom.
It's so easy to use.
Oh, it's
we don't have video of it. I wish we did. We only have third-party retellings. But I just wonder whether the guy just went, or if he was blushing.
I want to buy that kid a chocolate bar because that was just
Dad, Zoom. Are you using Zoom now? I've been trying to get people to use Jitsi, which is an open source, and I even set up a Jitsi server out of the house, and I like it. But this is Jitsi right now. Hello, everybody. But for some reason, actually, anybody wants to go in twit.team/twit768. We can see how many people we can get in here. But for some reason, even, you know, the less sophisticated technology users in my family can't figure this out. They know Zoom. They go, oh, well, let's just use Zoom. We know how to use Zoom. Everybody likes Zoom. So that's what we end up using just because everybody can figure it out.
I know lot of people who cannot figure it out.
Oh, good. All right. What's the easiest to use?
I think for most people, it depends how many people you're talking to. FaceTime seems to be the easiest thing for most people to use. But if you need a group, we use Hangouts at work. We use Zoom for some things. I mean, we sort of switch around. Blue Jeans, we've used Microsoft Teams, you know.
Really? Oh, wow. Okay. There's someone there then. No, I don't know.
We use it. Some of our clients who are Microsoft shops, who, you know, we use it for them.
Right. So. Yeah. I mean, we tried Zoom, and a couple of the people in the office really like it. Personally, I'm not that enamored with it myself. Hangouts seems to work, but I don't know about you, and there was an article about this week, but I am finding the amount of video conferencing really more wearing than I thought it would.
I don't know what part of it is wearing, although I've kind of, you know, we've worked asynchronously or synchronously as a team remotely for 15 years. So this is not new for me, but I don't.
There have been a number of articles about Zoom fatigue. One of them talked about how people aren't used to seeing themselves on camera all day. And so suddenly all of this, kind of insecurity comes up and people
I block my own video.
Yeah. Just
I
don't look at yourself. Just don't look at yourself.
Yeah, you see, I mean, I have to have the video going if I'm going to sort of do the costume thing, but it would be nice to block it. And also, you've got to, 1994, one of my first writing jobs was doing some freelance work for a PR arts company, and this will be the year of video conferencing. Now, I've been hearing that deadline ever since, but this actually is the year of video conferencing. And it's been very interesting seeing how people have adapted to it. Yes, it's kind of wearing, but it's the first time my family have actually done video conferencing. It's the first time we've done it as a team. And also, you have to enforce some rules. For example, I am wearing trousers.
Ah, good man. Good man. I'm not only wearing trousers, I'm wearing braces, so there's no accidents.
Oh, very nice.
No accidents allowed, yeah.
But you can tell
you're wearing what?
I'm wearing a train. This dress has a train on it.
You have a train? Where'd you get this dress? Was this when you won the Oscar?
Yes, that's when it's when I won the Oscar for best human thing.
But you see, I mean, you can spot in video conference etiquette is really quite important because you can spot that. Oh, I'll just go and get this and doing these sideways.
No pants. I can tell.
We've got
9 people now in our Twit team conference. But you have to see how many people haven't turned
on
their microphones.
Purdue?
Some, I don't know. Beef team comes from Purdue. I don't know if this is a
Purdue College of Pharmacy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Huh.
Oh, great mask, by the way, mate.
That's John. That's our board op. We require him to wear a mask in the studio at all times. Yeah.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Have you seen the alien face hugger masks? I so want one of these.
Oh, like from
German
Half-Life?
Guy has done like the alien face hugger, the alien face hugger thing with like a strap going around the neck. I want one of those so badly. You know, you could freak people out walking down the street.
I actually got a sewing machine. Oh, there's a kitty cat. I got a sewing machine.
Bless.
And I bought a bunch of fabric, and I've been making masks, and I've been looking at different patterns, trying to find the most comfortable, most effective mask. It's kind of fun.
You know, you can print your own fabric, you know. We've been doing that. So
with a 3D printer?
No, I mean, we also have a 3D printer. No, we're sending this to somewhere else, but you can send them, you can design whatever you want.
Oh, I want to do that. Oh, yeah, then, because I want twit masks.
Yeah, so I just made my...
Yeah.
Secret I made for my husband's practice. I got his company's logo.
Is he still working?
There are yes and no.
Because you have ophthalmologic emergencies right?
Yeah, like some idiot got metal in his eye like 3 days ago.
Right.
Was like, oh, it's fine. And now his eye is all inflamed and it's gooey and gross. So that everybody in the area, a lot of the specialists said they don't want people clogging the ER. Somebody's got to treat it. They don't want to clog the ER with people who really aren't that kind of emergency. So there's a lot of the doctors in the area who are specialists are sort of on call or staying open for emergency cases, which is what he's doing. And he's got to be, you know, masked up.
Right.
And
he has to have PPE, right? Is he more worried about giving it to somebody or getting it from someone?
I think probably both. He sees a lot. He's does a lot of very complicated diagnoses, and so he is a lot of elderly people coming in and out. He doesn't want to get anybody sick, and he doesn't want them to get sick because they came to the office, and he doesn't want to get sick, and nobody wants to get sick.
No,
you know.
No.
Yeah.
Let's take a little break with Lady Amy Webb joining us from the Future Today Institute for the Future Today. And from the Register, it's Lord Ian Thompson. Actually, I can't think of two people I'd rather be quarantined with. Man, I just think the conversations would be great. Yeah.
That's and very nice we of
are
you.
We are now up to 13, unlucky 13 people in the Jitsi server there.
Everyone's being very coy about their cameras as
well. Looks like somebody's got us on the big screen. That's Turbo. That's nice. You can add your name. Oh, there's Dr. Mom. Hi, Lil. I recognize Lil. So,
Leo, what is this called?
It's Jitsi, which is an open source JITSI.
That's cool. I want to try it. Okay.
Yeah, and what's nice is it uses WebRTC, so you just send out a URL. Right. You don't have to install anything. It's the only thing I don't like about Zoom. I don't like to install the Zoom software.
I'm kind of surprised WebRTC didn't take off faster. I guess with you guys remember Project Morpheus from a billion years ago that was trying to create a decentralized internet. I kind of thought that WebRTC, I think that dissolved because of political infighting, but I really did think that WebRTC was going to sort of take off and hit the masses much faster than it has.
Yeah. I mean, coming back to what we were saying also, one of the things I'd really, we have to call this out because this is just socially inappropriate. When you're in a mass Zoom call, there's always one bugger who's just like, oh, check out this new background and check out, and now I'm a potato and now I'm Cubist.
Yeah.
It's the worst kind of show-off stuff.
We had a little disease with the Snap camera app.
Oh.
And there was a disease that kind of spread throughout the company, and I fell for it. Everybody fell for it a little bit because you get bored after a while, and it's fun to be a potato.
That's one way of, you know.
Let's take a little break, and then I want to. I think we can do. I have some thoughts about, and I really want to quiz you guys about how the world might change in some interesting ways, like education, for instance, how this might set the tone for a whole new way of being. Self-driving automobiles, or in particular, self-driving delivery vehicles. There's some interesting technologies that might be forwarded by this, and I'm curious what you think. And then maybe some technologies like, in fact, autonomous vehicles for end users might be held back a little bit by this. I'd like to talk a little bit with our guests, the futurist Amy Webb, and a man who lives in the future, Ian Thompson. Our show today brought to you by LastPass. Because of their sponsorship, we can bring you that breaking news. We can bring you our shows. They have been very good to us this year. And boy, you know what? I couldn't be happier because I've been a LastPass user, a happy LastPass user, for more than a decade. LastPass is, of course, the world's best password manager, but it's so much more. And as you send your workforce home, you got to remember they now are a potential security risk. But LastPass can make that transition from in-office to in-home a lot easier. You still want the IT team to be the gatekeeper, right? You don't want to give them, give up their control, because after all, these resources, like your banking, like your databases, like your website, these are the keys to the kingdom. LastPass helps IT stay in control over which employees are accessing which resources. It doesn't matter if they're working from home or working from the office. You get unified visibility over access and authentication everywhere. LastPass also makes sure that your employees have secure access to their work applications with tools like single sign-on, which employees love because it's so easy. They just tap yes on their phone, and yet it's more secure than passwords. And, of course, LastPass is the king of password management. They generate long, strong passwords and remember them for you in an encrypted password vault that can only be decrypted on your devices. LastPass never has access to it, never has the password. And it works everywhere you do. Windows, Mac, Linux, iOS, Android. Every time I install a new browser or set up a new system, it's the first thing I install. LastPass makes your team more productive, too, as well as more secure, because with LastPass folders in the LastPass Enterprise product, you just create, you know, job assignments, workflows. For instance, we have an ops folder. We have a business office folder. We have folders for the studio. Those different folders make it very easy to onboard an employee and say, look, you have access to these resources because we're going to add you to this folder. That's huge. LastPass lets remote employees securely share passwords across teams, so there's no friction. You know, the average business has 185 shared folders. It's critical for businesses to consider implementing policies and tracking reports on shared password activity to make sure employees are operating securely and not sharing passwords with people they shouldn't. And that's what LastPass does. Seamless collaboration with coworkers without reducing your security. And, of course, there are more phishing attacks, spear phishing particularly. LastPass reduces the risk of phishing schemes because it will never autofill passwords on suspicious websites. And for remote employees who are logging in through the VPN, LastPass adds an additional layer of security to your VPN through biometric multi-factor authentication. We couldn't live without LastPass, and that was even before this happened, and now we're so glad we have it. We're going to do an event with LastPass in a couple of weeks. I'm very excited. It's going to be a virtual event. It was going to be an in-person event, but of course, as with everything, it's virtual. Cybersecurity and Identity Trends Unlocked. Our guests will be myself, Steve Gibson. Actually, I'll be hosting the panel. I'm no expert, but Steve Gibson is. Andrew Keene, he'll be a lot of fun. And, of course, LastPass's CISO, Gerald Buchelt. It's Thursday, May 14th, 1 o'clock Pacific time. It'll be a live panel. We'll stream it at twit.tv/live. And afterwards, of course, it'll appear on the Twit events feed. We're going to discuss what the new decade will bring, how it's going to impact digital identity and authentication, both for businesses and individuals. We had a great event in Boston a couple of months ago. I'm very excited about this one. This will be virtual, coming out of our LastPass studios. May 14th, just put a pin in that. Save the date, 1 p.m. Pacific, twit.tv/live. LastPass, get security, easy but effective security across every access point with LastPass. LastPass.com/twit to find out more. LastPass.com/twit. Thank you, LastPass. I'm going to tip a little Louis XIII in your honor because, man, we couldn't do it without you. Thank you, LastPass. All right. Now that I've wet my whistle, let me just see how many people are in the jitsy. Holy cow! Nobody's turning on cameras, but there are a lot of people in there. If I turn on the sound, it'd probably go crazy. So this is kind of fun. It's open source. I got a server. You know, John, I think I'm going to bring the server in here because I think this is a better place for it than my house. Since we have that demo network open to the outside world, I'll put it on that. I'll bring it in the next couple of days. It's also my Minecraft server. You don't mind, do you? No. Schools. A lot of kids, sad to say, a lot of seniors not walking. Of course, West Point reuniting just for the benefit of the president. But most schools are having either virtual graduations, virtual proms, They're not getting to walk. And it probably is the case, I don't know, but this fall we may well be going back to class online again. My son, our stepson, my stepson, Elisa's son, Michael, 17, high school junior, he's been going to online school now for a year and a half, long before this, and he's really comfortable with it. But I kind of wonder, you know, we've heard numbers like 50% of students not showing up for online classes. And yet at the same time, there's a lot to be said for online classes. It can bring education into more homes. It can give you access to better teachers. Maybe you have to, you know, it also leaves some people out if you don't have internet access and laptops. What do you think, Amy? What is the future of schooling? Is this going to give us a new kind of way of thinking about education?
Yeah. So before I do that, can I just make a quick toast since we were toasting?
Please.
Of course. So all of the healthcare workers are obviously, you know, putting their lives at risk to help us all. But there's a whole other group of unsung heroes that get no credit, and that's everybody working in IT, all the sysadmins, all the network engineers, everybody yes. that nobody knows
yes.
who are making this possible, who are stressed out of their gourds right now, trying to make sure that all of these systems for school, for work, for everything stay active. So just want to say thank you. I've got an empty glass, but thank you.
Yeah. I've got to say, yeah. Same with us. I mean, our IT support guy at the Reg is based in Italy. So he's been under lockdown for about 2 and a bit months now. And as it turns out, he doesn't really like people, so he's quite happy with it, but his wife isn't. But yeah, these are the people who are keeping us going, who are keeping the entire infrastructure of the nation going, and they deserve our thanks.
Yeah, we have our own IT people. And of course, our studio engineers, John's here. We have somebody who has to be here every single day, and Russell is staying in touch and working with us too. And absolutely, that is a tough job, even tougher to do remotely. And when you have to come in and splice cable or reset a machine, yeah. it's even more dangerous. And we have a lot of IT professionals in our audience. I'd say that's probably the vast majority of our audience. So I'll lift
so up. So good health to all.
Cheers. Yeah. Cheers. Yeah.
And nobody acknowledges the stress that you're under. I just want to say thank you. So,
yeah.
All right. School. So speaking of IT, so what would it take for school to have been changed? I've talked about this on the show before. We have kind of a unique setup. We built my daughter's internet, which is her own. And as far as she's concerned, she has access to everything. She doesn't. It's very, very locked down. And we've got these separate provisions for her, but we have a very, very strong connection. So again, I'm very acknowledging my privilege here. She's got no problem. She lives with two highly technical parents. And so for us, this hasn't been a challenge. Now, I know that every day her parents, the parents that are in this, her class that are trying to connect remotely are challenged. Not everybody has stable connections. Some people, for God's sake, are still using like satellite.
A lot of people. If you're in a rural area, you know, that may be your only choice.
That's right. Not everybody's on a T3, and everybody's got fiber.
Right.
There may be situations where you've got one device for a family. Mm-hmm. Printers are super useful when you're doing, you know, math and, you know, learning how to do equations and write things down. So I don't think it's realistic that we revert to some kind of online only system going forward. That being said, there are changes coming to education that I think we ought to consider. So one of those is that other countries were actually already set up to deal with distance learning in a way that we aren't. And that's going to give, and China is one of them, it's going to give them a competitive advantage. The other thing is that in the United States, our education systems are funded not an insignificant amount through the lottery. And people are not out buying lottery tickets.
What a mistake that was. Oh, my God.
Right? So a lot of states...
Hang on, you get a chunk of your funding from the lottery?
I wish I was making this up, but in a lot of states, it's different.
When we voted for this in California, Ian, the slogan was, the kids win too. The sad thing is that the people who run the lottery are basically Vegas back house gambling ventures who have very much made sure that the profit mostly goes to them.
Yeah.
So the issue is the revenue that was designated. So like that line, and schools are already, public schools for the most part are running super, super razor thin margins. So you have the lack of, anyhow, so this is super bad. And the question that I keep coming back to is I'm sort of less interested in the technology at the moment and more interested in what 20 years from now does our workforce look like? Because we will have had there's all this longitudinal data on why early childhood education matters a lot and why words like volume of words over just sort of screen time that's passive. And we know that passive screen time is going way up versus active learning, which is going down in a lot of cases. So 20 years from now is also about the same time that projections are, you know, assuming that things stay constant, that's when some of our AI starts to make leaps and we start to see more technological unemployment. I'm not worried about the implications for right now. I'm actually worried about education, the negative impacts of education 20 years from now. You know, yeah, we have less funding.
You see, I mean, I have the next door neighbors on both sides of me are teachers. Holly teaches kindergarten and Jennifer teaches music. Now, the music teaching profession has had an absolute, I can't say it, but a pain in the fundament about this. But what's really shocked me about this is the lack of support given to teachers, because they were basically given, you know, like a 3-hour course in how to prepare video calls.
Yeah. And talk about heroes.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Although,
and it's not just the technology. The syllabus has to change too. You can't
stand up there and lecture. You can't say, Janie, what's the answer? You can't, it doesn't work.
Well, So I also, I'm a professor at NYU Stern School of Business, and we went to online, the whole school went to distance learning like at the very beginning of March. We were kind of set up to do that because I was already, I teach this foresight, but I do it using a lot of different tools. So we were kind of okay, but a lot of classes, you can't just take the existing syllabus and make it work online. It doesn't work that way.
Although there was I think it was Benedibus who was saying, he basically came downstairs to find his kid playing with a dog, and he's like, aren't you supposed to be in class right now? I said, well, actually, I got a 20-second video loop of me looking attentive, and I just run it in the video stream, and I can get on with other things. And he goes, I was half outraged and half so impressed.
Yeah, he's learning skills, maybe not the skills you want him to learn, but still, you can't deny.
Hey, that's useful in the real world. Yeah. You know,
that's very clever. Yeah, I mean, I think higher education is one thing, but I think when you're talking about K through 6 or even K through 12, where you're talking about no socialization, no social life, our poor son who's been doing online school, he at least had a social life. We would make sure that, you know, there were kids around the rest of the time. Now he's going nuts. He's so sick of us. You know, it's just really a challenge. So I don't mean to say that everybody's going to say, oh, this is the greatest thing ever and we're going to do more of it. But I do think it might impact how we think about teaching. It's certainly going to impact how we think about the inequality in access to the internet, to technology in general.
We forget 5% of Americans don't have internet access. Yeah. I mean, and frankly, for the country that invented the internet, that's pretty shameful.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's still people on dial-up. There's a lot of kids who, with the schools being closed, don't have access to laptops anymore. How are they supposed to learn?
It feels like, and I don't know where the money comes from for UBI, but it feels so. I don't really, the economics never kind of clicked for me. I read as much Andrew Yang as I could.
We just had a UBI. Everybody get their $1,200
checks. That's right. I wonder if that's not something in the future as well as some sort of universal basic income. There certainly needs to be universal internet access. I wonder if that's not in our future a little bit.
Well, I mean, if there is universal basic income based on what they're saying, is it Steve Manchin saying, oh, $1,200, that's good for everyone for 10 weeks?
Yeah,
really?
No.
10 weeks?
No.
Yeah,
no,
that's...
No. Well, even Andrew Yang only proposed $1,000 a month. I think it's got to be $2,000 a month easily.
Our economic structure, it does. We are too big of a country, and there are too many people, so it doesn't work at this kind of scale.
Yeah,
is the problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
But
I mean,
universal.
In the UK, aren't they doing something like that?
In the UK, basically, they're doing what's called the government will cover 80% of someone's salary for the next 3 months, up to £2,400. So that's about $3,000.
That's pretty amazing.
Well, I mean, it's
plus you have universal health care. So
yep.
Really, you've got a life net, a safety net for anybody. They're not going to starve and they're going to have medical care.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's the basic social contract in that, you know, government isn't just there to, you know, facilitate business. It's there to actually make life better for its people. Now, OK, in Britain, 80%, I think. Australia's done 75, Netherlands has done 90. There's also signs of some firming up in terms of European countries not giving bailouts to tax exempt to people who have offshore their companies have offshore their taxes.
I love it that the cruise lines, which have all flags in Panama and the Caribbean, are saying, but we're American companies, help us out. No, I don't think so.
Well, no, not just the cruise liners. I mean, look at Richard Branson, for goodness sake. Virgin Atlantic is asking the UK government for a $500 million bailout. They're based in the British Virgin Islands. Ask the BVI for your bailout, please. Yes. Don't complain to us.
Didn't they also declare whatever the UK version of bankruptcy is?
I don't think he's done the bankruptcy. He did sue the National Health Service because they refused to give him a contract. But I mean, if anyone in the UK's public perception has gone down, Richard Branson has gone from being that cuddly left, you know, sort of alternative billionaire, has gone to utter scumbag. If he sets foot on the country again, we will hunt him down.
Didn't he offer to mortgage his Necker Island in the?
Oh yeah, his private island. That's so good of him. Thank you very much.
I'll give you my private island. I'm only going to give you the left private island. I'm keeping the right private island for myself.
Yeah, you know, and also this private island has been burnt down once and has had two hurricanes. It's not exactly a great investment. apart from tax purposes. So, you know. But I mean, you've seen the same in the US. This sort of huge bailout fund, and it's going out to hotel chains and restaurant chains. And
I'm so glad Ruth's Chris Steakhouse is going to survive.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, my local grocery store is down on its uppers. They're keeping themselves going.
Well, then there's a lot of anger about the fact that big stores like Walmart can stay open when smaller stores cannot. A lot of anger about that, and I understand.
Well, I think again, that's a state by state.
Yeah, here in California, smaller stores are open, but in some states they're not.
And in some states, everything is open. Right. This is the problem. If we were serious in this country about stopping this, you can't half-ass it. And I think the problem is, so if you want every state, if you want to go back to a state-led model, fine. Then every single state has to deploy its National Guard and nobody can move in between the states. And then once you have proven a certain level of, you know, once you are able to show that your infection rate has significantly deteriorated, right, is significantly down, and there's some kind of standard. And also you can prove that people aren't going to infect others nearby, then you can reopen them. But what we are doing in the United States is not coordinated enough, not good enough. And unfortunately, we're not New Zealand. We're connected, you know, every state is connected to other states.
No, I mean, it seems like we're crashing the economy for no good reason because we're not actually doing the follow-up work that needs to be done. You know, lockdown is all well and good. And, you know, I don't know how it is on the East Coast, but in the Bay Area, they've actually been pretty good about the lockdown. But that doesn't really help us unless we actually... Right. Track infections, isolate them, and lock them down. And I've got to say also, there's been some pretty shameless showboating by tech firms with, you know, like Uber Eats going out or, and, you know, the food delivery places, like, just remember your food delivery driver. It's like, no, in this kind of situation, you buy direct from the restaurant and you go and pick it up yourself. Why pay the middleman? You want the producer to stay alive, not the middleman.
I don't know. I think you should pay them both. Those people are probably a lot of, I would imagine, a lot of the people doing deliveries and Instacart shopping right now are had other jobs until recently.
Oh, yeah, certainly. But, I mean, if it's a choice between keeping the middleman going and keeping the actual producer going, I pick the producer.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What are there any industries that are going to see a benefit from this? Yes.
Huge. Yeah.
We've already started. So those working in the area of – so, like, within segments of AI, like computer vision, automation – as it relates to automated small delivery, like, so Neuro, Uber had a fairly successful pilot running of autonomous delivery vehicles in Pittsburgh until at one point it was, they were trapping people in wheelchairs out in the street because nobody had trained the system to recognize wheelchair as an object with human in it. Oh.
So they had to I was going to say for fun or what?
No, it's just... no so, but, but, you don't have people outside. So again, what would it take for X to be Y? What would it take to see a faster acceleration? We've got the conditions right now for that to happen. I'm also seeing an influx. I was already, but I'm certainly now seeing an influx in synthetic biology investment. And, you know, if it's the case, if we can redefine biology as technology, which is a little controversial, but if we can think of ourselves as code, that can be programmed, that it's programmable, which we can now. So synthetic biology.
Do you think like Elizabeth Holmes is thinking, if I could only have held out?
Well, I mean, so it's kind of no joke though. I mean, Amazon was already working at home-based diagnostics on all kinds of systems and services. Google and Apple are also working on diagnostic tests outside of a lab. We are seeing the problem that occurs when you've got too much consolidation with basically two labs, Quest and LabCorp in the United States, the rest of the system becomes brittle. Again, these become accelerating factors for greater investment in home-based diagnostics, home automation, single data records linking all of this together, all of the machine learning and the deep learning ecosystem and the AI used for scientific discovery. I mean, these are things are all interlinked. So all of that is going to see an acceleration going forward. See, so if you're somebody who's like, hey, I'm an engineer and I kind of have, you know, some interest in these areas, like that, those are good areas to be looking at right now.
I am curious, though, on the automated car front and sort of on the automated drone front, the big players, yes, they're pushing forward on this, but there does seem to be a sort of drying up of VC funding for the, you know, the younger players who are trying to get to scale first. So it seems as though sort of a lot of startups are now really struggling for money. The VC funding seems to have cropped up. Do you think we're going to see a sort of consolidation around the, you know, the first leaders, or are we going to see some kind of, you know, spring of new ideas?
Right. So nothing that I was just talking about is new. It's what I'm describing as an accelerating factor that wasn't present before.
Okay.
And within the, So like synthetic biology has its roots like back in 1992. And a lot of the Uber in Pittsburgh using little delivery drones is like, that's been around for a while. I think the problem is you've got, you know, the VC community and the private equity community tend to be chasing the shiny a lot, you know? And I just envision them chasing the new shiny, which is technology related to automating parts of the logistics and the supply chain. So things having to do with like private 5G infrastructure within manufacturing plants and factories, scraping and using metadata that comes from the collaborative robotics and the 5G systems. I see money like potentially going in that direction, which has a feeder effect back to automated delivery vehicles. If, you know, so maybe we don't see like a ton of new neuro competitors or whatever. And maybe some of that funding dries up, but the rest of the factors that lead into that ecosystem are moving forward.
You wrote a book called The Big Nine. It's all about the Big Nine: IBM, Alibaba, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook, Tencent, Baidu, and Apple. Which of these companies are going to see huge growth because of COVID-19?
Yeah, so this is one of those cases where I really wish... So that pragmatic scenario, the middle of the book has three scenarios: optimistic, neutral, and catastrophic. That neutral scenario is starting to take shape, which is a concern for me because it leads down a dystopian superhighway.
What is the neutral? What are the signature features of the neutral?
That's much just sort of more pragmatic. And pre-virus, I was studying, again, like tech companies intersecting with health, which has been going on for a while. Tech companies intersecting with farming and agriculture.
Right.
In a lot of countries around the world, the government just stopped funding basic research, so somebody else had to step in. So I'm not against Google or Apple or Amazon necessarily building out the future infrastructures of healthcare, but I think if we're going to rely on them to do that, and now we see an accelerating factor in the virus, we have to demand traceability, accountability, explainability, transparency—you know, like transparency—and that needs to be in place. If not first, then while this is all happening, you know,
what happens to the tech lash?
I don't know that there is tech lash. I mean, I think that there is among my friends and probably your friends, but I think if you ask the average person doesn't actually know. To the average person, Amazon is just the place where you get stuff from on the web. They don't know what AWS is.
Even if there's a low hum of, privacy, Google. I know a lot of people don't have Amazon Echoes because they don't want Amazon to listen. But that low hum doesn't stop them from shopping at Amazon.
No. And, you know, Walmart is a technology company.
Right.
You know, we just don't talk about it that way. And I see people responding. So again, like, what are people really upset about? I don't think they're really upset about their privacy. I think they're upset about other things. And it manifests in like, let's go after Amazon. Let's go get Amazon the bad guy. Let's go get Google the bad guy. I think that people are actually angry about other things, and they have absolutely no idea what these companies actually do.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing that drives me nuts about this. It's just like, well, you know, it's just like I just order this stuff and the rest of it. And it's just like, yeah, but if you actually look at the kind of data they're collecting, and in many ways useful, but in many ways deeply disturbing. And I think one of the things this has done is widened out an awful lot of technology. I mean, people used to order from in my experience, people used to order from Amazon, but they still went down to the shops. Now they can't go down to the shops. It's up to Amazon to provide that. And I think that will lead to a bit more focus as to what these companies are collecting and what they're using this data for. And particularly to come back to our earlier point about the healthcare apps. We're about to give out a huge amount of healthcare information to companies who we have no real guarantee they will use sensibly.
Right. So again, I'm not necessarily against it. I just want to know what the plan is, and I want that plan to be articulated in a way that everybody can understand.
I think, though, that a lot of people are just going to say, we don't care, just fix it. Just get rid of the virus. We're done with it. Whatever works. Mm. Don't you think?
Yeah, unfortunately. But the problem is it's not going to happen that way. Barring a super perfect vaccine, which comes out amazingly in the next 9 months, we're going to have to put up with a year or two of this, as Amy said.
I understand that. I'm just saying, I think that the backlash, tech lash, has turned the other way. And now people are mad at privacy advocates like you, Ian, for slowing it down. Stop. We want this.
Hey, bring it on. You will thank us later.
I think the backlash is going against the privacy advocates. They're saying, we've heard it all before. Look, we're going to give up some privacy, but we need to because we got to get better. We need our jobs back. We need to be able to go to the mall. What's going to happen to the football season in September? All of that stuff.
There, yeah, there, I mean, no, no person should have any belief that they are private. That there is no more such, there's no such thing as privacy. Privacy has been dead. I mean, dead for a while. So the challenge going forward is to be, maybe to have sort of a better sense of understand, like a better digital street smarts, right? A better understanding of what data are being scraped, under what circumstances. And there has to be some accountability. These, you know, the companies have to explain which, what data brokers are, who they're using, how the data are being transmitted. Cause it's, you know, it's the obvious stuff. Like people sort of get like that their faces are being recognized. They have absolutely no conception of what ambient data and ambient computing are and metadata, right? All of the other sort of digital emissions that, that are coming from us and from our homes and from our offices and, you know, all of it.
I mean, you reminded me of a very the famous phrase from Sir Scott McNeely, which was, you know, privacy is dead, get used to it.
Right.
And then when the Edward Snowden revelations came out, he tweeted out, it's just like, wow, I had no idea quite how bad, how correct I was. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, okay, we all use some of us use Facebook, and you don't actually put your personal, I mean, you put personal feelings on Facebook, but you don't. You've got to be careful about what you put on there, because otherwise that data is going to be sold off. And it's the same with Twitter and the same with any form of social media. You have to be careful about what data you're putting on there. I agree with you. Total privacy is dead and gone. But I'm willing to fight the rear guard action. You know, it's just, I'm not willing to hand all this stuff over. It's like all these Facebook polls for, oh, what are your 10 favorite albums? Yeah, I'm really going to tell Zuckerberg what my 10 favorite albums are. So I can get spammed out with, you know.
Well, but so that's the text-based, that's the obvious information. I'm talking about, so Snap in 2015, 16 or so filed a patent on, it was a computer vision patent that would allow it to recognize any object in the frame of the photo that somebody was sharing. And then they were developing an auction-based ad server to sell you ads against whatever was in that frame. And this is, so like, I understand that anytime I'm transmitting data of any kind, that there's, you know, it's multifaceted. My point is that the average person doesn't recognize that. And so it's not just your face that's being scraped. It's all of the ambient data around you that others can use, right?
I had to ask my mother-in-law to stop doing these bloody Facebook quizzes, because basically she's handing over my entire account to a third party, and we need to crack down on this. But at the same time, the ambient data, there's just so much that can be logged now. But I'm still not quite convinced about the advertising argument, because, to use your example, yes, you can see these things in the background. You've already got them. You know, it's like I'm so sick of ordering something online and then getting spammed out by,
that's where the behavioral biometrics. So this is where the other piece of this comes in. So if somebody has a profile of you and there's enough PI, your personally identifiable information, that the breadcrumbs that follow you around, those old books sitting on your shelf could potentially tell an algorithm that you then would be interested in Glenlivet something. I don't know.
Right.
We have zoomed in on the books to read the titles so that we, but you know what? They're not looking at the books. You're going to get a slew of ads for martini shakers, for gin, for, you know, fancy trips to Caribbean islands. You're clearly telling the world something very different with
Well, but it's not just the let's think about content bigger and broader. So it's not just advertisements. It's also what shows up in your newsfeed. We and the amazing audience listening to us are all discerning consumers of news, but that is not true of everybody. And in this age of algorithmic determinism, where we don't have somebody human thinking about the factors that go into making these assessments, you start to get led down digital rabbit holes.
You should never,
shape your opinions.
Never follow the podcast recommendations that you are offered. You should always just listen to us, because there's no algorithms on this end We're just throwing stuff out, hoping it sticks. There's no news feed here. There's no clever algorithm behind this one.
But no, I mean, you talk about the books behind me. Yes, I'm reasonably aware. So I went through that bookcase and I took out all the embarrassing, the John Grishams and the Wilbur Smiths.
Oh, you've been reputation polishing, Mr. Ian Thompson.
Damn. Oh, come on. Right. No one else does that on the planet. I will say, the other side, the complete Harlan Ellison. I highly recommend it. He died last year.
Yeah, very
and
good.
And the guy was a genius. But I mean, seriously, you've got to be aware of your surroundings. You've got to be aware of what data you're giving. But, you know, it's the fact is that most people aren't.
And I don't think they, honestly, I don't think they need to be. I don't think they want to be. I think when they hear people talking about it, they go, oh, you're just a bunch of cranks. It's the other side of 5G's causing COVID. It's just it's just more noise.
Of all the crazy nonsense that I've heard, linking 5G to COVID is probably the strangest and the dumbest.
I think what you have to do is you have to think, what is the psychological reason for that? And it's like Ned Ludd. It's, you know, the modern times are causing the COVID. What's the most modern thing in my neighborhood? Oh, it's that 5G tower.
Yeah, but I mean, people in the UK, we've had 25 G towers burned down in the UK at the moment. I mean, it's just the rank.
But there's a psychological thing. It's not, you know what, I don't feel like you think people are rational. People are not rational. They act emotionally and then use reason to justify the emotional thing that they chose.
I fear your wiser head may be right on that one, but I got to say, when you've got a bunch of D-list celebrities going, oh, well, you know, 5G might be the cause. No, it bloody is. It's just like, you know, it's like saying can openers are a cause of botulism.
It's obviously nutty. I wonder even if the people who are destroying the towers feel the same way, but it's just so satisfying.
We see, at first I thought it was like kids under lockdown, go out, do a bit of vandalism, make yourself feel better. Fair enough. It's a British tradition. But when you actually get...
Because it's not happening in other countries as much, is it? I don't think we've had any 5G vandalism here.
A few cases in Europe, but other than that, fine. But, you know, if 5G really was the cause of this, you'd expect the highest outbreaks of coronavirus in 5G areas, like Finland, where they've had one
death. It's patent nonsense. It's obviously nonsense.
No. So I always like to figure out why. So, like, what was...
Yeah.
What is it that people are seeking in this? And I think it comes back to certainty. There's a problem with having too much data. Sometimes too much data is bad, and sometimes not enough data is bad. Too much information is sometimes bad. Not enough information is sometimes bad. That is the current situation that we are living in. And I think with 5G, which is kind of like difficult to actually understand, I think the problem is you have some people with too much of the wrong information and then a whole bunch of people with no information. There's no center ground where cooler heads prevail.
Yeah. And also cooler heads don't make great headlines. You know, no. I mean, it's shame. There's a British paper called the national paper called the Daily Express, which used to be a very good paper, but is now all about asteroids and, you know, conspiracy theories and the rest of it. My gran used to read that, you know, and took it as gospel. You know, we do have this information overload that we're, you know, and people are just like, well, I read it on the internet. And we need to teach media savvy to people just to, with anything that you read, who wrote it, why did they write it, and who paid for it to be written? Those are the three key questions you have to ask.
All right, I want to make two columns. It's like tired and wired, but it's not. It's like pre-COVID, post-COVID, or no. So, for instance, no malls. Co- malls. Pre-COVID, there were malls. Post-COVID, no malls.
Amazon,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's like 100 shopping malls that are due to close over the next month or so. The numbers are staggering.
They're not coming back.
Permanently.
No.
Yeah.
Sad to say, a lot of restaurants are gone, won't come back, right? Because they're out of business. Anything that was hanging by a fragile thread, that thread's being cut right now, right?
And that's the stuff.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, right. I, our local Indian place is they've seen their takings drop by 80%. It's the same with every other restaurant. I have to an apology for British listeners at the moment, but I went to get my this may cause amusement. I meant to get my growler filled at the local pub. Now, for American listeners, growler, it's the bottle that you fill your beer up with.
Yeah.
British listeners, it's something rather rude. So
you took a growler to a recently. There's no way they would have put beer in that.
He's
doing his bit. A lot of beer is going stale in the barrels. We need you to drink more beer, Ian.
Our local brew pub sells growlers for 2 hours a day. So this may cause amusement for British friends, but a nice young man filled my growler with his fat pipe.
Drive-in movies making a comeback, right? We can all sit in our cars. Rolled up the windows.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, remember in 1965, I'm old enough to remember going to the New York World's Fair, and AT&T had a video phone. They said, by 1970, we'll all be using video phones. And I remember in 2001, in 1977, movie 2001, he's on the moon. He's talking to his daughter and his wife on Earth via a video phone in a video phone booth. And it never took off. All of a sudden, we're all making video calls. I think this might have been the impetus to finally get us over the hump, because we didn't want to. I think people didn't want to, but now they're making video calls, and I don't think we're going to stop. I think that that's something that's changed dramatically.
I mean, I think within the IT industry as well, one of the big changes is going to be conferences, because conference season
it's over. Conferences are over. I'm not going to CES ever again.
Well, no, I mean, CES at the end of the year. Okay, sorry, Amy, please.
Conferences are not over for a couple of very practical reasons. The first of which is that humans are social. So there is no way people are going to opt for no gathering or a virtual gathering over an in-person gathering. It might take a year for us to get back into the swing of things. But to me, this is a little analogous to after 9/11, when everybody said nobody's going to fly again. We have to sort of wait it out to have the new protocols and for people to feel confident. And then everybody's going to be back on planes.
Is anybody going to go on a cruise ship ever again?
Well, that's you. You're the one who cruises.
Yeah.
You tell us.
I was talking yesterday with Johnny Jett, our travel guy, and his thesis was you're not going to see widespread air travel or cruise travel or maybe even conferences until we have fast universal testing, so that you can go to the airport 5 minutes early, get a swab or spit in a vial, get tested. If you pass, you can board the plane. If not, you can't.
You see, at the moment, it's looking like countries are going down the route with, if you come into our country, you spend 14 days in quarantine before you're allowed out into the general population.
That's not going to work for touristic travel.
Well, no, exactly. Even Britain's just introduced this,
which
they held off on it for a long while. Israel was straight in there with a bullet. But that is going to cripple the air industry for a while. But I think for this year, conferences are over. It may come back. But until we get a way of either accurately testing or giving the golden passport to people, then mass conferences like CSA...
CES is over. I'm sorry. There will never be another CES. I'm going on record.
But, I mean, I'm a security journalist, and I was,
DEF CON and Black Hat? Absolutely. Yeah, that'll be back.
Yeah,
Southwest. Amy was going to speak there this year. That'll be back.
But when sorry, go, Amy. Yeah.
So we have a habit, we have a cognitive bias. When we think about the future, we tend to take signals in the present and amplify them. So everywhere in the world, there's a 14-day quarantine period. How would this ever work out for conferences? Assumes that, no other variable, external or internal, will change between now and some point in the future. So I would caution against, the inclination is to say the future will be like today, but much more.
I understand.
That's why
the difference between this and 9/11 is that was an incident, a point in time. This is a long term, and I think we're all going to have some significant PTSD from this. And I think people are going to become germophobic. At least our generation, the Generation C will be germophobic to the degree that there are certain activities, as much as we might want to do them, that we'll be reluctant to do. I wonder if movie theaters are going to survive.
Well, yeah, there are some. So what would it take for us to answer that question? What are the what's the revenue? And
AMC is about to go out of business, period.
Right. So how can they sustain in the short term? You know, my job really is about how do you sustain your operations in the short term while still planning on longer term growth? And the honest answer is there are a lot of companies, some industries that are going to sort of have to go on hospice. There is no such thing as a hospice for business.
That's exactly right. They're on hospice.
I wish we had like a hospice for business because that would allow people to say, listen, we're in a situation where 3 months from now, we're probably not going to exist. We acknowledge this. So it's not like a going out of business sale. It's a smart way to wind down a business. And I think that would probably be, you know, there are ways to do that and provide tax incentives and to do everything above board. And that would be a smart thing for a lot of countries to start doing right now is to figure out what does a hospice environment, what would a hospice plan for business
Some of it also is how vital that business is. I think sports will come back because we just really love sports. But I think we can live without movie theaters. We can live without malls. They're less essential.
I think we've got to come to a decision about what we're prepared to look after. And it's like, I love my local cinema. You know, love going there, the rest of it, that's fine. Sports team, yep, love that. But why on earth are we bailing out companies which do very little for us and not keeping the local companies which
that's true too.
Add so much to local life? I mean, Petaluma, if it was just a chain place, would be a terrible place to live.
Let's take a break. And I'm going to, this might be a little whistling past the graveyard, but I think we should talk about Apple selling Macs with ARM chips next year.
But there's no conference.
It feels so inconsequential, doesn't it?
Well, you know, honestly, it's going to be a big change and Google's plans as well. So, you know, you never know how this is going to work out.
Yeah. No, and your point is well taken. Obviously, Amy, it's very easy to have that, that bubble, be in that temporary present tense bubble and say, well, it can never be any different than this. But there are some things I feel like maybe we're better off without.
I agree, but I've spent a lot of time the past couple of weeks on the Internet Archives magazine section of the site where you can go through and they've got this amazing archive of old computing magazines like Byte.
Oh, I used to write for Byte.
So the whole archive is there, and it's really interesting. I mean, the most recent—I was reading a Popular Mechanics from the 50s, and one of the big stories was about from 1954 was about how there weren't enough computer engineers. Like that story has always been true in every single decade. It's true right now. So what does that tell us? That tells us that even when there are, and that was Cold War. We have to make a decision ultimately to create the future that we want to live in. If we don't actively make a decision, then things kind of just happen. So yeah, there's a ton of optimistic framings out there. I mean, I really believe that we could wind up on the other side of this 5 years from now in many ways better than when we started, but we have to decide that that's what we want to do. And then we have to have leadership and we all have to march together in the same direction.
What's the future of leadership in the new world?
Well, I don't know. I mean, speaking from the UK perspective and possibly also from the US, then we definitely need some kind of adult leadership because we're not getting it at the moment.
I wonder if we're going to embrace authoritarian leadership because they are, or could pretend or hope, offer us more effective leadership.
Well, I mean, Amy's more of an expert on this than I am in terms of sort of how societies react, but it's always struck me on my very limited sociology degree. MICKEYMOUSE. But I mean, people naturally defer to authoritarian leaders when they're scared and frightened.
Yeah. And Weimar Germany, this hyperinflation, the threat of communism,
Well, I mean, seriously, we're into global depression territory. But look at the unemployment statistics at the moment. We are into 1930s territory at the moment, unless something really changes. And I do feel that's going to lead to a more authoritarian and demagogic kind of politics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm not somebody who feels the sensation of being surprised very often. I found myself surprised in the wake of this virus, because if you think of I read a lot of sci-fi, obviously. In a lot of sci-fi books, in The Watchmen, right, in mm-hmm. movies, what's the, like, when things get really bad, what's the thing that saves us? An alien invasion. And when there's an alien invasion, like, that's the thing that brings everybody together, and suddenly, like, we're all working it out, and, like, humanity is one. This is our alien invasion. And when it occurred to me that that's what was happening, and the outcome is not as I was promised, which is everybody steps up, there's a level of maturity, kumbaya, and the opposite seems to be what's happening, which is what Ian described. I had a moment of like surprise, bad surprise, yeah. Surprise followed by stomachache.
I had the same thought that COVID-19 was Ozymandias's alien octopus.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. Maybe we're, you know, I mean, is Iran more or less of a nuclear threat? Is North Korea
going into this, we were already angling, you know, for years toward nationalism anyways.
Right.
So this becomes an accelerator.
But what's ironic is nationalism does not solve this problem. This is a global problem. Nationalism is exactly the wrong point of view to solve this problem.
But it makes people feel better, which is the eternal appeal of the whole thing.
Right.
I mean, the only way we defeat this virus is by acting internationally
globally,
in a coordinated fashion.
And by the way, coming right down next after the virus, climate change also requires a global solution.
Exactly.
Right. None of the problems are going away that we were already dealing with.
Right.
Yeah.
It is interesting, though, there have been a rash of stories this week about, one good side of the lockdown is that lower nitrogen dioxide levels in cities and that sort of thing. And it's like, yeah, but the fundamental problems are still there. Let's not forget about that. I mean, California hasn't had more than, two or three weeks rain this entire winter? And that seems to have been forgotten. And now we're all this stuff is still going on. Let's not get overly locked down on coronavirus, because there's a host of other stuff to be dealt with, and we really should be getting on with it.
Yeah. Our show today brought to you by CashFly. Literally, quite literally, CashFly is our CDN, our content delivery network, and it's been doing this since 1999. We haven't been using it since 1999, but we've been using it for almost 15 years. In the early days of Twit, I was puzzled, stymied by the challenge of delivering terabytes of data to listeners all over the world. We tried BitTorrent. We certainly, web downloads weren't going to work. Then along came Matt Levine from CashFly, said, "Leo, let's talk." And CashFly to the rescue. We've been on CashFly ever since. And now we do petabytes a month of data, audio and video, delivered to you seamlessly, quickly, and at a predictable cost, thanks to CashFly. One of the things CashFly does for us, and will do for you, is smooth out the spikes. You know, our delivery is very spiky. In fact, I would guess for a lot of companies, it's not a smooth curve. You know, there are some days where you just get a lot of downloads. And if you have a normal delivery system, you might be worried about exceeding your cap at any given time. You might be worried about the bill that's suddenly going to come due. With CashFly, they take your usage, average it out over a year, so you get consistent billing and you never have to worry about those late nights where suddenly a lot of people download the show and you go, oh no. CashFly is doing even more to help you with something they call 100% Cash Shield. One of the unknown costs of a CDN is your cash hit ratio. If you can get it to 100%, you're going to save a lot of money. But if you have a lot of caches aging out, suddenly you're downloading a lot of content from your source, and you may have, you know, Amazon expenses, big expenses with these data transfer fees. Cache hit ratio is awesome. You're basically buying some storage on CacheFly, and that becomes your origin. It brings your cache hit ratio to 100%. No more surprises. Plus, your customers are happy because 100% cache shield means no buffering. Data's there every time, whether it's a web page loading, a video buffering, your games downloading, your podcast arriving on time. Everybody wants to be faster. Your customers expect it. But when your cached items are being evicted for large one-off requests costing you a fortune in data transfer out fees, that doesn't feel so good. With 100% cache shield and CacheFly's guaranteed availability, there's a simple way to avoid it. It's a next-generation content delivery solution for today and tomorrow. A dedicated storage space just for you, keeping your content closer to your customers without the traffic of other companies. You can purchase as much space as you want. Your data will always be fetched from 100% cache shield rather than your origin. Shielding reduces origin spend by thousands a month and guarantees no cache misses. It's also going to dramatically improve download speeds, eliminate buffering, guaranteed availability, the highest quality of service, scale your video streaming to reach global audiences of any size. It's a great scalable solution for gaming. Now we're all doing that, right? Gaming online. Your podcast will be delivered quickly and reliably without delay or timeouts. And by the way, I could testify, it works. CacheFly's awesome. You get lightning-fast digital download speeds for large files no matter where your customers are. And because CacheFly servers are all over the world, they can guarantee 100% availability. 100%. CacheFly's global throughput performance dominance ensures any cache misses are delivered 5 times faster than from your origins. So even if you do have a cache hit, it's coming from CacheFly. And it's fast. CacheFly right now will give you a detailed analysis of your current CDN bill and usage trends and show you how much you can save. This is a little bit of a complicated calculation. How much storage should I buy? You know, how much should I pay for Cache Shield? How much is it going to save me? They can help you. They can get this all clear so you know what you're getting. See if you're overpaying 20% or more for your CDN. And if you're not on a CDN, why not? Twit.cachefly.com. Learn more. Twit.cachefly.com. Thank you, CacheFly. Thank you, Matt and team, because you have saved us year after year after year. This is a little movie we made highlighting some of the fun things, and I mean some fun things that happened this week on Twit Watch.
Previously on Twit.
Hey, I wanted to wish a happy birthday to Joe. Happy birthday, Joe. It's his 40th.
Happy birthday.
We closed the studio. Why don't we stop having people
kidding
in the studio
me
early? He can't be here. I'm sorry, Joe. You know, maybe you're on your 41st. Actually, at this rate, maybe you're 45th. Maybe you're 51. I don't know.
Hands-on iOS.
I am going to tell you about family sharing, an incredibly powerful feature that, frankly, most people should probably use.
Hands-on photography.
So you got your camera and you're thinking about upgrading to a new camera. Should you?
Hands-on
yes,
Android.
Yes, always.
Coming up on Hands-on Android, I heard from an emailer who has a question about removing bloatware from his Note 10 Plus.
iOS Today.
For a lot of people, the camera on their laptop is really pretty poor. And if you're doing Zoom meetings or Skype, it must be a little frustrating because you own this amazing camera in your iPhone or even your iPad. Why can't I use that? Well, now you can with a product called Epic Cam.
Twit, still essential.
Thanks to all of our, you made such a good point, Ian. Thanks to all of our Twit team who work so hard at home, editors working out of their house, engineers who have to come in, risk their lives to watch me spew. It's a really great thing. Thank you, everybody, for working so hard. We have a wonderful team. And thank you for supporting us. We really appreciate it, all of our Twit family members. We have Twit 15th anniversary. I forgot to mention this last week. Last week was our 15th anniversary of the original first Twit episode. And there is 15th anniversary merchandise available at the Twit store, twit.tv/store. We're going to get you a test Ian, because I think you're going down. twit.tv/store. Get those 15th anniversary. We got it. What? You know, I asked our marketing guy, don't they have Twit 15th anniversary masks? We've got onesies. We've got mugs.
So you got a baby onesie there.
Yeah, why don't we have masks? I want masks. I want Twit 15. I might have to.
I like those hoodies.
They're great.
Some merch.
We'll send it to you. Don't worry.
I'll take merch.
It's on its way. You want some merch? You got some merch. Anybody?
Nice. Honestly, I do love the onesies because I went to, what's this called? This is going right back. This is Server 2008. Went up to Redmond for a talk there.
And they gave you a onesie?
Went into the Microsoft shop. And they had a clippy onesie, which is like a baby onesie.
It almost makes you want to get pregnant just to get the onesie. Like,
well, no, it's just like, looks like you're trying to raise a baby. Would you like some? And I was just like, I have to get this. I gave it to a mate who was having a kid.
Is that what it said on it? That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
So that I know for a fact that onesie has now been passed down to the third baby. So it's just you know, that was a good purchase. But
looks like
remember when they tried to re-release Clippy?
Oh God!
Last year was that
Clippy
last year?
Clippy will never die. Clippy, it's gonna come back.
This was like Clippy with AI, supposedly.
Yeah. I mean, they're trying to do it with Cortana, but it just. I swear, I was at the 2003 Office launch when they announced that they were turning Clippy off by default, and the entire room of journalists was just like, "Yes, at last, that irritating little thing is gone."
You know, nobody talks about this, but Microsoft was super early to voice and to digital assistants. I mean, Cortana, they had the infrastructure way before everybody else did. It's just
so. How did they fumble it?
Yeah, that's the key.
Yeah, I mean, the Windows phone, which I thought was actually pretty decent little phone, just didn't have this. This is where the ecosystem comes into play. That's so it's not enough to have a great, and this, Ian, goes right back to what you were saying about the startups and investment. It's not enough to have a great technology. It's not enough to have a great technology with demonstrable use cases. You have to have the ecosystem around it. And I think the problem with that Windows phone was no ecosystem. The problem with Cortana was no ecosystem. And for a time, no clear direction on what they were doing internally with Cortana and what AI was going to be for Microsoft and with Microsoft. So I think that, you know, I read all the academic research and their team consistently produces very strong research on machine reading comprehension and, you know, natural language, like a lot of the core pieces of spoken interfaces, but you got to get it somewhere being used.
Hey, does anybody use your analysis for stock market investments?
So I have to be very clear that I am not.
You're not allowed
not making
to
investment advice.
No,
I mean, I advise the Federal Reserve, and I worked with
that's pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel that Microsoft has suffered a sort of Xerox PARC situation about this, where they developed all these great technologies and then just let them lie fallow. And then trust me, if you get a few beers down me and get me talking about Microsoft and Nokia, I will swear to the rooftops because they got this idea, we'll buy Nokia. We'll substitute Windows Phone for the Symbian operating system, which Nokia was stupidly holding on to, and everyone will flock to that. And it didn't work. They wrote the entire investment off against tax when we paid for it, and Nokia died. And Microsoft has this real problem between developing these great technologies and just complete inability to bring them to market in any way that anyone wants.
Yeah,
I don't understand
it. I could not agree. I could not agree more with every word that you just said. And it's a shame. It's a shame because some of the technology that I've seen and read about is far superior to a lot of what we have access to.
Oh, it makes Siri look like a complete Cortana
totally.
In its early thing made Siri look like a complete joke, but they just dropped the ball.
So I've always thought Microsoft is invisible infrastructure, and they should accept that and embrace it. The world does not work without Microsoft. So become the invisible infrastructure for the enterprise, and maybe don't worry so much about the consumer space. But like, go all in and build amazing products.
I kind of think that's what Satya Nadella is doing, to be honest with you.
Don't think it is?
I do think it's what he's doing.
Oh. No.
I think he's an Azure guy, and I think it's been very interesting to watch Windows going from being the crown jewel to something a little less.
Yeah.
Well, it was when you got Server coming out in Linux. It was just like, wow, this is something Steve Ballmer would never have considered
They're putting a Linux kernel in Windows.
I know. It's great.
I love it.
You know, it's just, I mean, when you think back to the Ballmer years where he was throwing chairs around.
He said Linux is a cancer.
Well, I mean, he said the iPhone would never take off because you couldn't have a phone without a keyboard. All of this stuff.
It wasn't too bright.
I mean, okay, Ballmer was a great sales guy. Don't get me wrong. Lousy CEO. And Satnav has really turned the company around. And yeah, I think Microsoft's on a good course. I just wish they could actually take the technologies they use and implement them rather than, you know, or just concentrate on being the back end and let the flashy companies do the rest.
If it weren't for COVID, the absolute huge story this week in technology would be this scoop from Mark Gurman at Bloomberg. And because it's Mark, I think it's credible. Apple aims to sell Macs with its own chips starting next year. Apple has had some remarkable chip technology, but it's only put it in iPads and iPhones. But in fact, one of the other headlines that was interesting this week was one of the Android blogs, Android Police, bemoaning the fact that Apple's cheapest iPhone, the iPhone SE, which just came out, has a faster processor than any Android phone. Any Android phone. And that's because Apple's A13 and its chip technology is superb. But is it ready for desktop? And that's a very interesting question. Microsoft has famously put out some ARM Windows. They have Windows on ARM, and they put out some ARM devices that have been less than stellar.
You're being very polite. Come on.
Actually, you know, the Surface X is not awful.
But not awful is not really a great recommendation for a product. Look, Windows on ARM has always been a complete loser.
Yeah.
And it's great that Apple's doing their own chips. Google is reportedly, Axios was saying, also doing their own chips. But, I mean...
And Intel, by the way, a number of people have said COVID's going to kill Intel.
Well, their financial results this week didn't suggest that.
No.
We've seen double-digit growth in the PC market this quarter because everyone is stocking up on new computers to work from home with.
Yes, but TSMC is going to they have 5 nanometers. They're going to 3 nanometers. You've got AMD coming on strong. It does feel like Intel might be facing some pretty strong headwinds going forward.
I think you're right on one level in that they haven't managed to crack the mobile market. Atom is just a complete dog. We've got, you know, they're still focused on the x86 architecture. And yeah, they're going to get their lunch eaten for them by, you know, the rest of them. But Intel has kind of dropped the ball for the last 5 years now. You know,
it couldn't happen. They deserve it. I'm not saying they don't deserve it. They absolutely deserve it. I don't think Apple's such a big customer of Intel that them going to ARM chips or their own design chips is going to be a huge hit for Intel. But what is interesting is if you can get ARM chips in the network centers, in servers, that's going to be a big problem for Intel.
But you see, they've been trying to do that for a couple of years now, and it doesn't seem to scale as well as it might.
If they can lick that and get these low power chips in very power heavy environments like network centers, that's going to be amazing. That's going
to
be.
But everybody's moving to. There's been a greater move to making chipsets in part because of AI, right? So you've got custom chipsets, right?
Google announced AI can design a computer chip in under 6 hours this week. Six hours.
Was it a good one, though? You know, it's...
Well,
so the design is one thing. You've got to get it manufactured, though. And so, again, this is where it's useful to think through, are we going to suddenly bring the manufacturing sector, like, are we going to move it out of Taiwan and back into the United States?
Still have to build fabs.
And
fabs
right.
have gone from $1 billion to $10 billion. These are very, very advanced technology.
But there, I mean, there's still a fab base in Germany. There's a fab base in Israel.
Are there no fabs? Do we not? Doesn't Intel make chips in Oregon? Are there no fabs in the U.S.?
A few, but they're scaling them down. I mean,
I thought the preponderance was
lunacy.
Taiwan, yeah.
Yeah. And also, when we lose Taiwan to China, then that's going to be a major thing to, you know, to deal with, because that's coming down the line.
Is it?
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
I mean,
China's moving. Yeah, totally.
What?
Just
that's World War III, isn't it?
No, because we'd lose.
Who's going to come in and
yeah? I mean,
mind-melded.
Yeah, I mean, sorry. You're actually going to try and fight a war against China? Yeah, right. America would get its ass kicked.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just not going to happen.
China will
absorb Taiwan over a course of years. They're hopefully going to do it peacefully, but it's going to happen.
Kind of like they've absorbed Hong Kong.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, China is very good at not starting wars but still getting what it wants. And, you know, all this stuff about, well, Taiwan is an independent nation, please. You know, we couldn't defend Taiwan if we tried.
It's really interesting to watch the deference that the World Health Organization and others have given to China, because in the same way that Trump's minions give deference to him, when somebody has a lot of power, it's hard to speak truth to power right to their face, isn't it?
Well, sorry, Amy.
Ian, you go and then I'll say.
Okay. I will say this. Taiwan dealt with coronavirus better than pretty much anyone else on the planet. They locked down the state quickly. They isolated. They backtracked the infection rates they got. And as a result, they've virtually been untouched by this. But if you honestly think that America is going to be able to win a war against China over the control of Taiwan, it's not going to happen. China's going to walk in there in 5, 10, maybe 20 years' time, and they're going to own the processor technology that's there. So, you know, we're just going to have to deal with that.
Well, we're already pretty reliant on China, so I guess it won't be that much different. But we'll come back and wrap this up in a second. Our show today brought to you by Stamps.com, which is absolutely vital. We know the U.S. Postal Service is absolutely vital to small businesses. But these days, you probably don't want to go into the post office. But here's some good news. With Stamps.com, you don't have to. Everything you would do at a post office, you can do right from your desk with your own computer, your own printer, and Stamps.com. You don't need a postage meter. You don't need special ink. You just need Stamps.com. And by the way, not just the Postal Service. Stamps.com also offers UPS services. And in both cases, you're going to save a ton of money. You'll print postage on demand. You can save money with discounts you can't get at the post office. A nickel off every first stamp, up to 40% off USPS shipping rates. And now with UPS services, discounts of up to 62%. And I don't know if you knew this. I found this out when I was talking to Stamps.com. If you're shipping UPS to a residence, you pay a residential surcharge unless you use Stamps.com. They got UPS to waive the residential surcharge. That's going to save you. Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to the computer in the safety and comfort of your home, your office, anywhere else you're hunkering down. Now, we use it here at Twit. And the nice thing is I can bring it home, because Stamps.com works wherever you are. If you've got a printer, you got a computer, you can send packages, you can print stamps, you can send any package, any letter, any class of mail, anywhere you want it to send, put it out on your doorstep, the Postal Service picks it up. You can schedule a free package pickup or just leave it outside for their, you know, normal appearance. No human contact required. I mean, this is what you're looking for. And if you're an Etsy seller, an eBay seller, an Amazon seller, we ordered some masks from Etsy. They came $8.50 postage due. That just does not send a good message to your customers That's a bad idea. You want to look professional? Stamps.com. And there's no equipment to lease, no long-term commitments. And this trial we're offering you, this is the best ever. We've been using Stamps.com for years, and I highly recommend it. Right now, you're going to get a special offer that includes 4 weeks free trial, plus free postage, a lot of free postage, a digital scale, no long-term commitment. Just go to stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in TWIT. Now more than ever, stamps.com is going to save you money. Stamps.com and save you time, and it's safe. No contact email, U.S. mail, no contact UPS. This is what you need in this time. Stamps.com. Enter the offer code TWIT for this amazing special offer. Yeah, I hope you take advantage of it. This is the time to do it. Stamps.com. We thank them so much for their support.
So from a game theory point of view, what would it take for us to increase our military? What would it take to have an engagement that involves force? I don't think that it would. I think it would be a losing game for either side to escalate to that point. What's more likely is that China reclaims Taiwan and we don't stand in the way.
Yeah.
But don't for a second.
Is that because of the nuclear deterrence?
No, I don't think it's a nuclear issue. I think this is an economic issue. And I've been advocating in the DOD that we think about, we have to redefine warfare. And this is a tough one for all of the labs around the country where they do advanced physics research, nuclear research, and all the rest of it. We have to start thinking about war in economic terms. You know, what would it mean for a war to be fought in code versus combat, or using economic measures in ways that we haven't seen before?
Is conventional warfare between superpowers a thing of the past?
Well, I don't know about superpowers, but I can say
there's conventional warfare going on right now in many, many areas of the world.
Well, no, I mean, if the U.S. decided to defend Taiwan, let's look at it logically. You've got a 4,000-mile supply gap, which you're going to get harassed by Chinese submarines the entire way there. China has spent the last 30 years developing anti-aircraft carrier technology, which is going to make even, you know, the best U.S. aircraft carriers huge targets, which can't be defended. If the U.S. goes to actual physical war with China, that's my biggest fear, because it might end up nuclear, in which case we all lose. But what I suspect is going to happen is that the U.S. will make some noises. China will slowly absorb Taiwan in the way that it has with Hong Kong and Taipei. And that's the way they work. They don't start wars. They would just win them.
Yeah. Amy's been talking about this on our shows for a long time because she's an expert on this. And you've been talking about the Belt and Road Initiative, which is China's kind of economic hegemony plan to spread itself throughout the world. And it seems very difficult to counter. Do you see us going to a cyber war? Do you see that as being a credible deterrent of some kind?
Here's what I think has been happening. Our parts of our military have been reorganizing. And I think that there has been a greater focus placed on preparedness as it relates to code. The challenge is that we have a very long history of fighting war in a very different way, a way that is tactical and requires building things and blowing things up. So that's fine. The whole point of our military is preparedness. So the question is, are we preparing the right way? I wonder if nuclear is really the big challenge going forward, or if it's attacks against our critical infrastructure and security flaws, you know. And to me, cybersecurity feels more imminent and problematic than the threat of nuclear escalation. So when I say, you know, how can we think about this in terms of economics? When you look at the Belt and Road Initiative, which is one of many, many policies So China's been building physical infrastructure along the old Silk Road route, in part. Mostly it's in emerging economies and emerging markets, but they've also been laying fiber and digital infrastructure. And so what happens if there's a non-contiguous but like huge swath of the planet in Africa, Latin America, parts of Europe that are aligned with China and we're locked out? You could cripple our economy slowly by compromising our supply chains, our travel routes, our trade routes. I mean, there are a lot of different ways to wage war against another country that don't require guns and ships. And,
it's almost,
you know,
like a siege.
Airplanes.
It's almost like a siege.
Yeah, yeah. So, but
isn't this just what the U.S. did to the Soviet Union in the 70s and 60s and 70s, where, you know, we went into developing countries, we said, yeah, let's build this great infrastructure. Yeah, you owe us a certain amount of money, but you can pay that. And China seems to be copying exactly the same playbook, that kind of soft warfare.
Yeah, and I do want to just caution against continuing to think of China as a copy-paste culture. They were totally scraping everybody's IP and copying it. Like, everybody knows that. But I think things have changed over the past decade or so, and they're innovating in their own right, and certainly when it comes to policy. So the bottom line is they've got people on the ground. So, like, we don't have, like, our state departments, our companies have, like, started, you know, for a long time, we haven't had people on the ground in all of these places. China has. So they have relationships. They understand each other. They've got a cultural sensitivity and awareness, you know, and our sort of,
we're number one.
What's that?
We're number one. So
I was going to say, like, why? America's like, balls out, like, here we are, you know, like, but you know what I mean? Like, that might have worked in the 90s. That doesn't work in the 2020s. Like, there's a different way of doing things. And somehow, you know, and this predates Trump. This goes also back to, has been sort of
it's been going on for years. Yeah.
Yeah. So we kind of like missed the boat. And it's not just the U.S.
I don't know if there's anything we could have done. I mean, certainly economic dependence on China wasn't a good idea.
Well, no, but I mean, we've come back. It comes back to the central idea of hard power and soft power. America's always had this, you know, we are the hard power. We have the military. We have our nuclear arsenal. And we've got the soft power, the cultural, everyone wants to be like America, the rest of it. Well, the hard power is gone. Basically, America hasn't won a war for 30 years and its military is in complete mess at the moment. Soft power, that's dissolved over the last 10 to 15 years as well. China is perfectly willing to step into that as far as I can see. I'm open to suggestions, but it just seems like we're kind of painted ourselves into a corner on this one.
I agree with all that, but I would offer a little more credit to the U.S. military. There's been a rotating cast of characters, and certainly there's been a whole bunch of bad headlines over the past couple of months.
Yeah, but long as you got nukes, I don't know if it really matters if you have a strong conventional force.
But you can't use nukes without killing everyone else.
I know, but it's simple as that. It's still a credible threat.
China wins a nuclear war. Mao was perfectly clear. Right. As long as 100,000 Chinese survive, we win.
Right.
So in my office, I have a picture of this guy. So this is Herman Kahn, who's
wow. It's a great picture. I don't know.
I keep a framed picture. So I trace my lineage as a futurist back to him. And so he was on thermonuclear war, right? And was at the height of the post-military industrial complex thinking about nuclear deterrence. And I guess my thought is nuclear weapons are bad. I think that there are things that are worse. I just do. I think the threat of biohazard is worse. The threat of algorithmic, like, cyber sovereignty is worse in some ways. So I think that the, like, war games of the 80s don't, obviously we still have nuclear weapons, so it's still an issue, but I don't think it's like the issue going forward. With apologies to Herman Kahn.
Wasn't Herman Kahn the guy who said a nuclear war is survivable?
Yep, but he did that for a particular reason. So he had access to, so he was also a quantitative modeler, and had access to classified Air Force data. And it's from him, actually, that we have the word scenario, because he was trying to figure out a way to get people to... the whole reason that he explained that it was survivable was because he wanted to extend the scenario of dropping bombs out to the nth degree for the purpose of people not doing it.
Right.
So, you know, so like in a way saying like everybody will be dead.
Is think about like, this. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's credited with saying we must imagine the unimaginable.
Right.
If we are going to confront deep uncertainty over very difficult questions. And so, but that's kind of the situation that we're in right now. Yep. Right. So I think it's good for us to think through, because like if we're really focused on like what's the future of nuclear deterrence, then we're not also paying attention to the future of bioweapons and cognitive enhancement and like many, many other technologies that meld with our sort of soft technologies or like market manipulation or all kinds of zero days. You know, maybe there's like an archive of zero days that nobody knows yet, that all get released at once and cripple our financial systems for X amount of time. We see now what happens when we cripple our financial systems for even a week. You know, look at what's happened.
It almost makes electromagnetic pulse look, you know, almost trivial, because
the idea of a neutron bomb that would destroy people, not buildings.
Well, I mean, the
actually,
old idea
EMP
in the 80s,
right? It would destroy.
Well, I mean,
technology.
The idea in the 80s was that EMP would just destroy the electrical grid, right, back to medieval levels. But bioengineering, that kind of stuff, really worries me. Because I mean,
right,
EMP, we're screwed. But bioengineering and the tailoring of viruses, that's a really nasty area to
be
in.
So this is where, so similarly to AI, this is where this is a really thorny issue, because viruses are not bad necessarily. Like just like with AI, like tech isn't bad on its own. Viruses aren't necessarily bad. They potentially do bad things. You could also theoretically create viruses to fix code, right? To do good things. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, there's a lot of you could create a virus to fight a cancer. You could create a virus to fight another virus. I mean, there's all kinds of opportunities here. However, obviously, you can also use all of this to humanity's detriment, just as you could use AI and its evolution to humanity's detriment. So we have like nuclear bombs are sort of like the Flintstones, like bam bam version of like mayhem. You know, we're orders of magnitude more sophisticated now in the year 2020, and I'm much more concerned about all this other stuff than I am about how nuclear deterrence goes, even given what stupid things the Trump administration did with regard to Iran.
What a smart conversation. Thank goodness I had the brandy, because I just had nothing to say. I could just sit here and sit back and enjoy.
Still finishing the whiskey, but I have to say, when the idea first came up, Amy was like, I'm so into it. And I was just like, yeah, okay, I'll follow that lead, because
we are the best looking, best dressed podcast ever. I just want to say
thank
just
you for giving us the opportunity. It was honestly just the act, like I've been looking forward to this, and the act of getting dressed up, I kind of feel like I should do this once a week.
Okay.
Even if I'm
okay.
Just I'm not going anywhere,
okay.
But
let's forget anybody else on this show, Karsten. It's Amy and Ian from now on. Actually, sometimes we have to talk about shiny objects every once in a while. You guys are too smart. That's the problem. And so we ended up talking a lot about some deep philosophical questions.
We're still geeks, so give us the shiny. Give us the shiny.
More shiny. No, I'm done with the shiny. We're done. But they did want me to ask you guys, and they think Amy has some special insight into this. I don't know. Kim Jong-un, dead or alive? What do you think? What do you know? What do you hear?
What's the over-under on
this
one?
What's the over-under?
I think he's dead.
I think he is too.
I do.
Now, there's a...
I don't know what it means.
That's hugely destabilizing, right?
Well, I mean, Occam's razor would suggest he's dead, in that Chinese, Hong Kong, and Korean sources are reporting things are slightly up. But let's not forget that it's enormously difficult to get information out of North Korea.
Yeah, we don't know. And we've had rumors that people are dead before that showed up alive.
What I mean, the U.S. State Department admitted that with his dad, they based an awful lot of their calculations on how much Hennessy vodka had been delivered to North Korea that month. You know, I mean,
it's all about the train, right? It's his train has been parked for three whole days at the Wusan. What's going on? It's based on that. So satellite imagery of his train.
And also, like, there was a Chinese doctor that had apparently treated him. I don't know. Like, I lived in Japan for a long time and am friends with a lot of Japanese reporters. They don't tend to report things unless they're verified. Japanese press doesn't really operate that way. So the fact that it came out of a reputable news source in Japan also makes me feel like it's a little bit more credible.
Yeah, but that means we've got a nuclear power with no clear leader. I mean,
there's also other family members around.
But you see, technically, his father is still the head of state. It's a necrocracy. His father is still technically the head of the North Korean state. But yeah, he's got a sister. He's got cousins. The military is going in there. I do wonder what's going to happen, though, with North Korea when they lose the nuclear focus. You know, it's like, what else are they going to do? It's like, well, we're the internet scamming nation of the world.
I could tell you exactly what they could do. You've got a population of people who could overnight become the manufacturing capital of the world.
Whoa.
I mean, easily. Ooh. And these are people who could absolutely.
So here's their opportunity. Let's get rid of the Kim family. Let's become a republic. Would China let them do that, though?
I don't know. And we didn't talk about Russia.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, China might be willing to let them do that if just to avoid floods of starving North Koreans heading over their border.
Yeah.
But at the same time, yeah, they could become the manufacturing capital of the world, but in what conditions? I would like...
The human rights abuses would be horrible.
Yeah,
but,
I know. I mean, the amount
what are you going to do? You can't do anything, so okay. At least we'll get the new phone.
Well, you can refuse to buy from them, but yeah, I mean, it's just like, look, North Korea is, I'm trying to think of the equivalent, maybe Yugoslavia in the late 90s. I mean, it's going to fall apart. And the question is whether it falls apart in a way which benefits the rest of the world or whether we pay the price. And they've got nukes. We've got to be careful on this one.
Yep. Well, I'm glad I asked. I'm glad
that's really. Oh,
this has
really
been such an upbeat show the whole time, folks.
I would happen to say, however, that if you're looking to adopt a cat, this is a really good time to do it because there's a lot of cats out there. They will bring you joy, and we can move on from this.
Some brown or red foxes that I have available. If anybody'd like to pick them up in our backyard, there's a whole family has moved in.
Oh, we've got opossums in our backyard, and they're great. Possum, I never encountered them before I came here, but an opossum looks like a rat and a mole had a really bad one-night stand, and this was the...
They're the strangest animals.
Yeah, but they're really great, I found out. They eat ticks, they're not rabbits.
You know what's not great? The cry of the red fox. Johnny, you have my audio? This is what they sound like. You do not want to hear this in your backyard. Wait a minute. So we kept hearing that. And in fact, it was like in stereo. There was somebody in the front and somebody in the back. I don't know if they're mating. I don't know what. We kept hearing that. And I said, I think it's those foxes I saw the other day. And thank God for YouTube, because I searched for the scream of the red fox and I found it immediately. And so now we know what the red fox, that's exactly what I was hearing in my backyard the other day.
Now, you see, I grew up in London where we now have more foxes in urban centers than we do in the countryside.
There was a jellyfish spotted in the canals of Venice, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, I mean, but when you hear foxes getting it on, it sounds like someone's being murdered.
Yeah.
And it's just
terrifying.
And they are totally fearless. So, hey, more urban wildlife, I'm all for it.
Ian Thompson, you look good, Mr. Bond. Very good.
I had to take the jacket off and I didn't tie my bow tie myself like yourself. So respect to you, Leo, for actually doing it.
Mine's kind of lopsided because I realize it's too I have to adjust the length.
Yes, but you can pull it off in a dramatic fashion and have the two sides. I mean, this is the
epitome. Yeah, now you have to go sit by the piano.
Exactly. This is the epitome of cool.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Thank you, Amy Webb. Everybody should go to amywebb.io. You should buy all her books. I am so pleased to hear that the new book is coming. That's very exciting.
Thank you.
I can't wait to read that. And don't forget the Future Today Institute, where Amy hangs her hat 18 hours a day.
Not normally, just the past couple of weeks have
Holy
been busy.
Cow. Are you still offering your that book?
Yep. So all of our research is free. All of our frameworks and tools are open source and free. And as of tomorrow, we have an interactive version of the trend report, which has 406 trends this
year.
We made the whole thing interactive, so it'll be live tomorrow. And we also have a database that's going to launch in a week or so. So you can search through all the different trends and see how they interact with different industries. And yep.
And if you want, if you're in the Department of Defense and you're looking for a game theory strategician,
they already know where to find
you. They know where to find you. I bet they do. You know,
could I leave with one last piece of advice?
Yes, please.
So if you are sitting at home with your 9-year-old and your husband and nobody wants to do bedtime and you happen to be flipping channels to get somebody to try to fall asleep and Tommy comes on PBS, don't watch it with your 9-year-old as we did.
Tommy, the Who, that one with the Gypsy Queen played by Tina Turner, that Tommy?
Luckily, we had never seen it. So luckily it came on after the acid song situation.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
Did it give your daughter nightmares?
She just had a lot of questions about things.
I'm the gypsy, the acid queen.
I'm hearing laughter in the background, but this was the Pinball Wizard thing or the...
We turned it on right when Elton John was singing Pinball Wizard.
Oh.
So we came in at that point and then we stayed till the end. So my parting advice is don't do that. Moments in parenting.
Okay. What are you watching? What is a good show?
Ah, Dave on Hulu. I know, like, if you have access to Hulu, this is Curb Your Enthusiasm, younger and more humane. Oh, my God. It is great.
Okay. I'll trade you because have you watched Devs yet on Hulu?
I'm waiting for there to be more. I like to bank them and then watch them.
They're all done.
They're all done?
They're all done.
Then that'll be next. Was it great? I've been waiting.
Yeah. First of all, Nick Offerman shows he's got some real chops. I love the plot. I think you'll be very interested in it. And it has, you know, it's a challenging show and it has a perfect ending. I mean, I'm surprised because so many shows these days are great right to the very last episode. And then you go, well, that's annoying. This one I thought had a very nice ending. I highly recommend it. And it's right up your alley.
Okay,
sci-fi.
Cool. Yeah, I've been waiting. I'll watch it for sure.
They've built a quantum computer that has so much power, it can predict the future. See?
Okay.
Wouldn't you like that, Amy?
Well,
wouldn't you like one of them? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I would say from a British perspective, two series to watch, Derry Girls on Netflix,
which I
love dearly.
Derry, not Dairy.
Yeah, about life in Northern Ireland.
Okay.
And also, if you haven't seen Tim Pegg in Spaced, get on there. Spaced is the ultimate 90s British TV show. So that's what I've been mostly stocking up on this week.
I ended up subscribing to BritBox just because of you.
Oh yeah, it's a great channel. I mean, okay. I can't obviously endorse it, but it keeps me in my British TV.
What do you mean you can't endorse it?
Well, I mean, I can, but this is kind of.
I think you have endorsed it.
given the platform, okay, they're terrible. Don't watch them. They're really bad. You know.
Thank you, everybody. It was a great time. I'm so glad that we were able to dress up and pretend to be grown-ups on the internet. That's what it's for. Thank you, Amy Webb. Thank you, Ian Thompson. And thank you for everybody who watched We almost made 3 hours. If another 3.5 minutes, this will be a 3-hour show. Should we just sing a song? No, no. Let's see if we can get out of here before 3 hours. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon.
Small world.
Every Sunday afternoon, about 2:30 Pacific. That's 5:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC. You can watch it live. Audio and video streaming at twit.tv/live. Or just ask your Amazon Echo or your Google Voice, say, play Twit live. And you will get it somehow, some magical way. It will play for you. You can also ask for individual episodes. If you say, play this week on in tech, you'll get the most recent episode, which is not this one yet because we're still working on it. It hasn't ended yet. You can also get on-demand versions of this show after the fact. All of our shows at our website, twit.tv. Subscribe in your favorite podcast client. That way you'll get it automatically. No, I used to be back in the dim, dark past. I used to say, so you'd have it for your Monday morning commute. But now you'll have it for your Monday morning sitting around in your jammies eating pizza. So that's even better, right? Thank you for being here. Stay safe. Stay healthy. Another Twit.
This is amazing. Oh, bye.